Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. Here, the result is always positive. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, we discuss the mysteries of the universe and the Earth. When we are done, you will never look at the stars or yourself the same again. Whether you are in a truck headed for the coast or in a car driving across the frosty desert or working in your garage on your favorite project as you listen, you are about to learn more about where you came from, why you are here, and where you are going than you ever thought possible. In here, your potential is absolutely unlimited. I have a little bit of a sore throat tonight, so please bear with me this first hour. We have an absolutely fabulous program for you tonight. If you enjoy our bumper music tonight, it is all brought to you by the very talented Cell Dweller. It is industrial music, quite powerful, used in several movie soundtracks. You can buy it at celldweller.com or by visiting our website at x2-radio.com. Also, next month, the Arc of Millions of Years, Volume 2, 2012, and the Harvest of the End Times comes out. It went to the printer Monday of this week. It came out to 409 pages and will be available everywhere. If you want to get your copy first to add to Volume 1, you can get it at our website sometime next month at arcofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that A-R-K like Noah's Ark. You can always go to our website also for the latest information for our newsletter. And next week is Christmas, and we will be taking a day off to be with family. We will also take January 1st off due to logistical issues, and we will return on January 8th. Tonight, our program is on the subject of UFO disclosure. This is going to be a bonus program. I'm going to have three guests on tonight, and as usual, all through the night, you can call in anytime, toll free, at 888-268-4313, or you can email us at info@x2-radio.com. The subject of UFO disclosure cannot be covered in any depth without having at least two of the men who helped most with that effort. In our second hour tonight, we will have Dr. Stephen Greer, the founder and leader of the Disclosure Project. If you are listening live, you need to call your friends now and tell them to get online at bbsradio.com. and go to the X Squared Radio link and listen in. We may reveal tonight the newest and most incredible breakthroughs in finally getting the government to show us what they have. Right after Stephen Greer, we will have William Puckett, the owner of UFO Northwest. He has not only collected nearly all UFO public evidence, but has thousands of regular readers of up-to-date UFO findings, and he will be joining us tonight later during the second hour. And in our third hour, we will have the well-known and world-famous Dr. Fred Bell. He is going to join us and fill us in on his early work with the subject of UFOs, and I hope we can get him to tell us a little bit about what is widely acclaimed to be the most mysterious and maybe benevolent and powerful off-worlders on the Earth today, the Pleiadians. Now, dozens of millions of people have reported that they have seen UFOs. In recent polls, more than 77% of Americans believe UFOs exist. But Hollywood has made practically, well, it made it impossible for any young person today to deny their existence. The scientist in me says, there's no proof they don't exist. I have never seen one, however. I know this much. Humans do not possess a lifespan conducive to long-distance spaceflight. Even if we could travel at the speed of light, which we can't, not anywhere close to it, we could not reach the nearest star system with a planet nearly like Earth within 40 years of its launch. Likewise, there is no possible way any life forms would climb into a metal can and ride at the speed of light, if they could travel at the speed of light, to a planet whose first pale radio broadcasts reached their antenna a mere 20 years ago. Even at that speed, they would not reach here for another 20 years. If it was the detonation of the first nuclear weapon that put us on the map, they would have reached here in about 1985, provided they had long-range ship and crew ready to launch in 1945. The evidence, however, goes back to the beginning of time itself of off-worlder visitations. One of the things that we want to cover tonight in extreme depth, if we can do that in 3 hours, I don't know if it can be done in 3 hours, is all of the, well, all of the evidence that we have access to that the government seems to have collected on UFOs. And by government, I don't mean every single government worker. I think those of you that listen to this program are sophisticated enough to know that there are two governments, especially in the United States, more so maybe in other countries. Excuse me. In this country, we have the elected government. You know that one, the one you see on TV, the one you see on C-SPAN, the ones who go in an office and then when they come out of office, they write a book and they have, you know, memoirs and they have retirement benefits and things like that. The ones that take office and say, why, we're going to do something about making sure that a full investigation is done on UFOs. I have in my hands here, my stack of evidence, an article from the National Tattler of October 13th, 1974. This is 31 years ago. And this is a synopsis of an interview with President Ford. The revelation that the President and Vice President of the United States are concerned with the UFO phenomenon comes only a few months after national pollsters found that more than half of the American people believe that UFOs exist. Keep in mind, this is 1974, before Star Wars came out, and coming from other planets to visit us. Indeed, polls show that more than 15 million Americans claim to have seen UFOs. I dare say that that number is quite a bit more than that now. Further down in the article, it says UFOs have been sighted all over the United States and the world since World War II. The Air Force signed a $500,000 contract with the University of Colorado to make a scientific investigation on unidentified flying objects. 5 years ago, the committee headed by the late Dr. Edward O. Condon issued a report whitewashing the UFOs from the sky, but the report didn't slow down the public sighting of UFOs. A wave of sightings, the more dramatic ones being published in Tattler, mushroomed throughout the United States in the late 1973 and during the first few months of this year. Now, this is where it gets interesting. L.J. Lorenzen, executive director of the Tucson-based Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, told Tattler recently that the Department of Defense has decided to acknowledge that flying saucers from other planets do exist. Quote, a program has been undertaken that will, over the next few months, make obvious that the government has reversed its position, unquote, said Lorenzen. Now, if this took place in 1974. I didn't see anything in the next few months that showed that the government had reversed its position on the existence of UFOs. I further quote, "The government has previously consistently denied the existence of UFOs. Some factors Lorenzen took into account in forming his conclusions include the government's cooperation with film companies producing documentaries on UFOs, a reversal of official position. Lorenzen also noted that the international political competition is another factor. That is to say, fear that another country might upstage America by acknowledging that UFOs exist. The U.S. position on UFOs will likely soon be thrust into the open now that the country's top leaders are among those who haven't hesitated to make their beliefs known." Now, I didn't see anything in 1974 or 1975 or 1976 that had anything to do with a reversal on that position. And as far as being upstaged, it seems to me that we have had a very recent revelation, testimony, interview with, and I think most of you already have heard most of this interview, but we're going to read it because it's just a little bit. Paul Hellyer, former defense minister and deputy prime minister of Canada. He was interviewed by a person named Mr. Carlson. And he asked him, now, of course, you were the Minister of Defense of Canada when you autopsied that position, I believe under Prime Minister Lester Pearson. Did you come across any classified information that suggested UFOs were real? And Hellyer said, no, not really. We got regular reports that showed some of them were in fact unidentified. Some of the sightings could not be explained as natural phenomenon, but nothing more than that. And Carlson continues to press in. And this is what Hellyer said. This is what rocked the entire world about 3 weeks ago. Hellyer said, well, for the last 2 or 3 years, I have been looking at the evidence and assessing it, much as I guess a judge would, and trying to determine who was telling the truth and who wasn't. And I finally concluded, especially after reading a book called The Day After Roswell, written by Colonel Philip Corso, that unidentified objects are, in fact, real as the airplanes flying over your head, and that there has been a monumental cover-up for more than half a century. This is after, you know, looking at a lot of evidence and trying to discern who was telling the truth and who wasn't, and I have concluded unequivocally that the people who claim that they have either seen UFOs or have seen classified documents about UFOs or have seen wreckage from the crash at Roswell on or about July 4th, 1947, they're the ones telling the truth. And consequently, I am basing my policy considerations on that. Carlson says, well, where did you come across this information that the Bush administration is building a forward base on the moon? And why would they do that? Why would they keep it from the public? Hellyer said, well, to answer your second question first, I don't know. That is the reason I am raising the question, is to see why they are. Carlson. Well, how do you, that's an awfully specific claim. I haven't read it in the New York Times. Doesn't mean it's not true. Doesn't mean you're wrong, but I'm interested to know why you think that. I'm going to just insert something here. Why anyone would want to say that it's not so unless they read it in the New York Times is beyond me. There are many better investigative groups than the New York Times for this kind of information. Now we'll get back to it. Hellyer says, well, because this was forecasted in Colonel Corso's book, they were wanting to build a base on the moon as far back as 1964, and General Arthur Trudeau, same name as one of my bosses, was very determined to build a forward base on the moon and prepared all of the specifications necessary for it and the blueprints and so on. Carlson, well, it is, pardon me, I don't mean to interrupt you, but it doesn't, but doesn't this make sense? I mean, if in fact there are extraterrestrials and they are buzzing our planet, why would we want to take steps to defend ourselves from them? Why wouldn't we want to take steps to defend ourselves from them should they turn hostile? Hellier. Well, I think the critical question is whether or not they are hostile. You see, when the crash first occurred, General Nathan Twining later became the, in Roswell? Yes, in Roswell. After the crash occurred, he declared that they were enemy aliens. Now, there's no evidence that I have seen that would really convince me that they are, in fact, you know, the enemy. And what I would like to know is whether that classification of enemy aliens still exists or whether it doesn't. And if it exists, what the evidence is on which the United States government bases its conclusions. I think that's tremendously important. Carlson said, I think that's an entirely fair question. Now, finally, you laid out these views in September of this year at a speech at the University of Toronto, and according to the news report I have of the speech, your address, quote, ended with a standing ovation. I don't mind telling you that if I was there, I probably would have stood as well. And that implies, I think, that your views are commonplace in Canada. They are the minority view here, distinct minority view. Do you think most Canadians believe that there is a forward base under construction on the moon and that aliens are buzzing the Earth? Hellier said, no, absolutely not. Most of them are skeptics. Most of them haven't spent much time researching the subject, and so they're, I think the average here would be very similar to the average American. And I am hoping that maybe we can persuade the Canadian Senate to hold hearings and listen to some of the 400 witnesses that your Dr. Stephen Greer has compiled and hear them and, you know, make up their minds as to whether or not there is a real threat. And Carlson said, all right. And this is where Hellier really changes the tone of the meeting. And maybe this would be just enough to push the American government, the U.S. Congress or Senate, into holding its own hearings and then getting the United States government finally to come clean and tell us what they are worried about. Carlson said, okay. Canada's former Minister of Defense, Paul Hellier, if you are right, history will record you as a visionary. If you are wrong, well, I'm glad you came on anyway. Thank you. And Hellier said, it's a pleasure. Well, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, Earth explorers, is if you believe that the U.S. government has evidence that they have not revealed to the American people on the factual, and I mean factual, not opinionated, not eyewitness, a factual evidence that that UFOs exist. If you believe that, then there is only one way to make that happen. And that is by pressuring your elected officials. However, I was saying earlier that there are two governments. There's the one that you elect. There's the one you see on TV. There's the congressman you can call, the senator you can write. There's that government, and that's the small part of the government. The other part of the government runs in automatic. The other part of the government is what we affectionately call the bureaucracy. That means bureaus, many, many, many different bureaus. And they're funded by, well, they're funded by regular money that never has to be voted on year after year after year. It's automatic. The actual effect that the president or the Congress or the Senate can have on the expenditures of the federal government is rather small. It's about 20% of the expenditures of the government. 80% of the revenue that's pulled in off of taxpayers, off of tariffs, off of other forms of income that the federal government has devised for itself are all spent on projects that are running in automatic. Now, some of this is, of course, Social Security. Some of this is Medicare. Some of this is aid to foreign countries. But there is also a, well, what we call in the conspiracy world, black operations. By black operations, we mean that there's no traceable evidence. There's no audit trail. There's no connection. There are no witnesses. There's no evidence. And I don't know how many people out there have been able to do this. If you go out to Area 51 and you try to get on the compound, you're not going to be able to, because that's a secret military installation. Ah, there I said the word. In fact, all exploration into space by the United States government, even though it's under the auspices of the National Aeronautics Space Association, NASA, all of the crew, all of the ones that fly the missions, they're all military. Now, we do send scientists up to the space station. We send them up in the space shuttle. But those satellites that they place in orbit from Hughes and from other companies like that, sure, they have some beneficial benefits. Some of them watch the weather for us. Some of them created a GPS grid so that we now have some civilian access to it for global positioning of ourselves on the planet. Of course, the military has a much more advanced, much more sophisticated, much more high-resolution version of that. And they have made it clear that all of satellite communications, all the GPS satellite communications, can be seized by the government at a moment's notice in a time of conflict. But there are other satellites, many, many other satellites that have other capabilities. They photograph the Earth with infrared. They photograph the Earth with ultraviolet. When coupled with certain Earth-based systems, such as HARP and other systems, they can even X-ray the Earth. And yes, I think many of these do have a defense purpose. And it has long been said, and I do agree with this, that he who controls space controls Earth. With the right space-based weapons, you wouldn't be able to launch a biplane on this planet. With permission, clearance, and without being targeted for removal by a space-based weapon. That being said, there is a strong rumor, and I've heard it from more than one source, and I'm going to perpetuate it here, that there have been people that have gone to the moon. We've covered that on this program. One of our first programs, we had a long debate about whether or not we went to the moon. So what I would like to do is I would like to go through the astronauts in the system that went to space and went to the moon, and maybe some of the things that they saw. And then we'll also talk a little bit about the debunking of some of that data. The first we're going to cover is a man named Major Gordon Cooper. Now, Major Cooper, unfortunately, died at the age of 77 on or about October of 2004. But he was one of the original Mercury astronauts. I remember him. And the last American to fly in space alone. On May 15, 1963, he shot into space in a Mercury capsule for a 22-orbit journey around the world. During the final orbit, Major Gordon Cooper told the tracking station at Moochea, which is near Perth, Australia, that he could see a glowing greenish object ahead of him quickly approaching his capsule. The UFO was real and solid, because it was picked up by Muchea's tracking radar. Cooper's sighting was reported by the National Broadcasting Company, that's NBC, which was covering the flight step by step. But when Cooper landed, reporters were told that they would not be allowed to question him about the UFO sighting. Major Cooper was a firm believer in UFOs. 10 years earlier, in 1951, he had sighted a UFO while piloting an F-86 Sabre jet over western Germany. They were metallic, saucer-shaped disks at considerable altitude and could outmaneuver all American fighter planes. Major Cooper also testified before the United Nations, quote, "I believe that these extraterrestrial vehicles and their crews are visiting this planet from other planets. Most astronauts were reluctant to discuss UFOs," close quote. He continues, though, "I did have an occasion in 1951 to have 2 days of observation of many flights of them, of different sizes, flying in fighter formation, generally from east to west over Europe," close quote. And according to a taped interview by J.L. Ferrando, Major Cooper said, and I'll quote again, "For many years I have lived with a secret. In a secrecy imposed on all specialists in aeronautics, I can now reveal that every day in the USA, our radar instruments capture objects of form and composition unknown to us. And there are thousands of witness reports and a quantity of documents to prove this, but nobody wants to make them public. Why? Because authority is afraid that people may think of God knows what kind of horrible invaders. So the password still is, we have to avoid panic by all means. I was furthermore a witness to an extraordinary phenomenon here on this planet Earth. It happened a few months ago in Florida. There, I saw, with my own eyes, a defined area of ground being consumed by flame." One moment, please. Excuse me. I have a technical thing to get rid of here. All right. Too many phones ringing. The area was being consumed by flame, with 4 indentations left by a flying object which had descended in the middle of a field. Beings had left the craft, and there were other traces to prove this. They seemed to have studied topography, they had collected soil samples, and eventually they returned to where they had come from, disappearing at enormous speed. I happen to know that authority did just about everything to keep this incident from the press and TV in fear of a panicky reaction from the public. So you can see astronaut Gordon Cooper was thoroughly convinced that authority, the government, was trying to protect us from ourselves. And now we have Ed White and James McDivitt. And I have to qualify this up front. The McDivitt sighting and the McDivitt photograph is probably the hardest space evidence that we have up to this point of UFOs existing. I do know that through the Disclosure Project, that there is some hard evidence that was recovered that one of the astronauts gave up to the government, and he was able to finally sue through the Freedom of Information Act and get that evidence back. We're going to hear a little bit more about that hopefully later on. Anyway, in June of 1965, astronauts Ed White, first American to walk in space, and James McDivitt, were passing over Hawaii in a Gemini spacecraft when they saw a weird-looking metallic object. The UFO had long arms sticking out of it, and McDivitt took pictures with a cine camera. Those pictures have never been released. Now, that being said, there is some debunking out there that says that McDivitt never touched a movie camera. This is dated June 3rd, 1964, Gemini 4. Jim McDivitt reported, He photographed several strange objects, including a cylindrical object with arms sticking out and an egg-shaped UFO with some sort of exhaust. This is the most famous astronaut UFO case, and it has been embellished and distorted in dozens of publications. McDivitt saw a beer can-shaped object, which he took to be another man-made satellite. Some observers believe it was his own booster rocket, and tried to take a few photos, which did not turn out. A still from the movie camera, which McDivitt insists he never touched during the sighting, was mistakenly released without the astronaut's review, showing what turned out to be a light reflection off his co-pilot's window. According to McDivitt, UFO buffs took this photo and acclaimed it as one of the best UFO photos ever taken, showing, they claim, a glowing object with a plasma tail. McDivitt never saw anything like that in space. Verdict? Gross exaggeration and distortion on the part of UFO writers. Also, the year is wrong. It should be 1965. Well, let me just go back here and we will read the transcript from the actual communication between McDivitt and Capcom. This is they have a 29/40/45. McDivitt says, Hawaii. About, looks like 1 minute and 24 seconds later. Captain says, Gemini 4, Guaymas, Capcom. 3 seconds later, McDivitt, go ahead, Guaymas, Gemini 4, Capcom. Roger, we got you green. How are you doing up there? 3 seconds later, McDivitt, fine. I just saw something else up here with me. But just as I was getting close enough to take a good picture, the sun got in the way and I lost it. 9 seconds later, Capcom. Roger, we got some flight plan changes for you. Want to stand by to copy? 3 seconds later, McDivitt. Yes. Stand by and let me see if I can find this thing again. 16 seconds later, McDivitt. And there are a great number of thunderstorms around at the present time. Lightning is actually lighting up the interior of the spacecraft. Activity, thunderstorms. 10 seconds later, or actually 50 seconds later, McDivitt, okay, go ahead. Doesn't look like I'm going to see him again. And they inquire just a little bit more. Capcom is actually pretty open about it. They say, that's a firm. You still looking at that thing up there? 3 seconds later, McDivitt says, no, I've lost it. It had big arms sticking out of it. It looked like, I only had it for just a minute. I got a couple of pictures with a movie camera and one with a Hasselblad, but I was in free drift. Before I could get the control back, I drifted and I lost it. Capcom, good show. And that was the end of that. Now, that transcript clearly says that McDivitt did, in fact, use the movie camera. And he did use the Hasselblad to take photos of this cylinder. All right, James Lovell and Frank Borman. In December 1965, Gemini astronauts James Lovell and Frank Borman also saw a UFO during their second orbit of their record-breaking 14-day flight. Borman reported that he saw an unidentified spacecraft some distance from their capsule. Gemini Control at Cape Kennedy told him that he was seeing the final stage of their own Titan booster rocket. Borman confirmed that he could see the booster rocket all right, but that he could also see something completely different. During James Lovell's flight on Gemini 4, Lovell, bogey at 10 o'clock, high. Capcom, this is Houston, say again, 7. Lovell, said we have a bogey at 10 o'clock, high. Capcom, Gemini 7, is that the booster or is that an actual sighting? Lovell, we have several actual sightings. Capcom. Estimated distance or size? Lovell. We also have the booster in sight. That's all the communication that I have the transcript for. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin first and second men to walk on the moon. According to the NASA astronaut Neil Armstrong, the aliens have a base on the moon. And told us in no uncertain terms to get off and stay off of the moon. According to hitherto unconfirmed reports, both Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin saw UFOs shortly after that historic landing on the moon in Apollo 11 on 21st of July, 1969. I remember seeing that live on television. I remember hearing one of the astronauts refer to a light in or on a crater during the television transmission, followed by a request from Mission Control for further information. Nothing more was heard. According to a former NASA employee, Otto Binder, unnamed radio hams with their own VHF receiving facilities that bypassed NASA's broadcasting outlets picked up the following exchange. NASA, what's there? Mission Control calling Apollo 11. Apollo 11, these babies are huge, sir. Enormous. Oh my God, you wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you, there are other spacecraft out there, lined up on the far side of the crater edge. They're on the moon, watching us. A certain professor who wished to remain anonymous was engaged in a discussion with Neil Armstrong during a NASA symposium. The professor said, "What really happened out there with Apollo 11? Armstrong. It was incredible. Of course, we had always known there was a possibility. The fact is, we were warned off. There was never any question then of a space station or a moon city." The professor, "What do you mean, warned off?" Armstrong, "I can't go into details, except to say that their ships were far superior to ours, both in size and technology. Boy, they were big and menacing. No, there is no question of a space station." The professor, "But NASA had other missions after Apollo 11. Armstrong, "Naturally. NASA was committed at that time and couldn't risk panic on Earth, but it really was a quick scoop and back again." According to Dr. Vladimir Azaza, Neil Armstrong relayed the message to Mission Control that two large mysterious objects were watching them after having landed near the moon module. But this message was never heard by the public, because NASA censored it. According to Dr. Alexander Kazantsev, Buzz Aldrin took color movie film of the UFOs from inside the module and continued filming them after he and Armstrong went outside. Armstrong confirmed that the story was true, but refused to go into further detail beyond admitting that the CIA was behind the cover-up. Seems like a pretty simple thing to do, since there was ostensibly only a single point source of information, and that was the radio broadcast between Apollo and the ground, which NASA assumed would only be received by them and then rebroadcast on national radio and television. Unfortunately, some of the broadcast did not get fully redacted. Donald Slayton, a Mercury astronaut, revealed in an interview that he had seen UFOs in 1951. "I was testing a P-51 fighter in Minneapolis when I spotted this object. I was at about 10,000 feet on a nice, bright, sunny afternoon. I thought the object was a kite, and then I realized that no kite is going to fly that high. As I got closer, it looked like a weather balloon, gray and about 3 feet in diameter, but as soon as I got behind the darn thing, it didn't look like a balloon anymore. It looked like a saucer, a disc. About the same time, I realized that it was suddenly going away from me, and there I was running about 300 miles an hour. I tracked it for a little way, and then all of a sudden, the darn thing just took off. It pulled about a 45-degree climbing turn and accelerated and just flat disappeared. Major Robert White. On July 17, 1962, Major Robert White reported a UFO during his 58-mile-high flight of an X-15. Major White reported, "I have no idea what it could be. It was grayish in color, about 30 to 40 feet away." Then, according to a Time magazine article, Major White exclaimed over the radio, "There are things out there. There absolutely is." And I might want to bring the listeners up to speed on the X-15. It was dropped several times from a B-29 Stratofortress, and there was no booster rocket. So anything that the X-15 was seeing was definitely not something that fell out of off of the X-15. How about NASA pilot Joseph A. Walker on May 11, 1962? Joseph Walker said that one of his tasks was to detect UFOs during his X-15 flights. He had filmed 5 or 6 UFOs during his record-breaking 50-mile-high flight in April of 1962. It was the second time he had filmed UFOs in flight. During a lecture at the Second National Conference on the Peaceful Use of Space Research in Seattle, Washington, he said, "I don't feel like speculating about them. All I know is what appeared on the film, which was developed after the flight. To date, none of those films have been released to the public for viewing." How about Commander Eugene Cernan? Eugene Cernan was a commander of Apollo 17. In a Los Angeles Times article in 1973, he said about UFOs, "I have been asked about UFOs, and I've said publicly I thought they were somebody else, some other civilization." Maurice Chatelain, former chief of NASA Communication Systems, confirmed that Armstrong had indeed reported seeing 2 UFOs on the rim of a crater. Chatelain believes that some UFOs may have come from our own solar system, specifically Titan. The encounter was common knowledge in NASA, but nobody has talked about it until now. All Apollo and Gemini flights were followed, both at a distance and sometimes also quite closely, by space vehicles of extraterrestrial origin, flying saucers, or UFOs, if you want to call them by that name. Every time it occurred, the astronauts informed Mission Control, who then ordered absolute silence. How about Walter Schirra? I think that Walter Schirra aboard Mercury 8 was the first of the astronauts to use the code name Santa Claus to indicate the presence of flying saucers next to space capsules. However, his announcements were barely noticed by the general public, probably because one of his, when he came around the backside of the moon to the front side and was enabled to have radio communication with the Earth again, he said that Santa Claus did exist. It did happen to be Christmas Day. James Lovell. It was a little different when James Lovell, on board the Apollo 8 command module, came out from behind the moon and said, for everybody to hear, "Please be informed that there is a Santa Claus." And that was Christmas Day, 1968. The rumors persist. NASA may well be a civilian agency, but many of its programs are funded by the defense budget. And most of the astronauts are subject to military security regulations. Apart from the fact that the National Security Agency, that's the NSA, screens all films and probably radio communications as well, we have the statements by Otto Binder, Dr. Gary Henderson, and Maurice Chatelain that the astronauts were under strict orders not to discuss their sightings. And Gordon Cooper has testified to United Nations Committee that one of the astronauts actually witnessed a UFO on the ground. If there is no secrecy, then why has this sighting not been made public? Now, that being said, I am a scientist, and I can tell you that, honestly, I've never seen one. Oh, I've always wanted to. I've told you in the past, I've gone camping high in the mountains in the Sierra Nevadas, and I've been up 14,000 feet to Pikes Peak at night, and I have scanned the skies as much as anyone. I have never seen one. Have I talked to people that have seen them? Yes, many. And in just about every state that I've lived. And they record basically the same things. Bright orbs, discs, cigar-shaped things, orange lights, saucers, things that follow them when they go from one place to another at night. But, you know, it's getting to the point anymore where eyewitness accounts are just not enough. The entire phenomenon of the astronaut UFO sightings adds a lot more credibility to it than the average person. I know, we're thinking that school teachers and bus drivers and construction workers and cops and just ordinary people walking out in their backyards at night seeing things, that's pretty credible. But when you have trained professionals that are in a titanium can anywhere from 180 to 250 miles off the planet, and even going 275,000 miles away to another planet, the moon, and saying that they have seen things that they have seen, it would seem like professional suicide to me if a lieutenant or a captain or a colonel were to come back to this earth and say, well, I hate to tell you this, but UFOs are real because I saw them, and let me tell you, our little titanium can sitting there on the surface of the moon was a speck compared to how big these ships were. And they do, in fact, have a base up there. Well, now here we are, the year 2005, and recently, very recently, President Bush said that we are going to remount a manned mission to the moon, and that the express long-range plan of that is to build a base on the moon. One of the grave concerns of many people is that we want to protect space, specifically the moon, from moon-based weapon systems. We have a hard enough time fighting over land here. We have a hard enough time getting along on our own borders. The borders of the United States, the borders of Iraq, the borders of Russia, the borders of North and South Korea. We have a hard enough time getting along as Earthlings, pointing weapons at one another in some human standoff that we can say, we own this portion of the planet and you're not welcome here. I don't hold to the need, the necessity to have space-based weapons unless they know something we don't know. If they know that there is a hostile race on another planet that has the intention of conquest of this planet, I would think that it would not take them very long to do so with the technology that we have, or at least the technology that we have demonstrated in our own wars. The fact that if we wanted to build a moon base for exploration, a base from which we could launch craft to Mars much more easily, or launch craft to even other planets or other star systems, not having to overcome the gravitational pull of the Earth, I think that would be a marvelous step toward exploration. That would be a step toward having the global viewpoint that we are, in fact, Earthlings instead of Americans or Germans or Mexicans. There must be a way, as I was going to explain to you before, for if, in fact, these craft do exist, if they do, in fact, come from another planet, and it is evidence from the models and the years that they have existed and even the intentions of some of the races that have alleged interaction with those of us here on the Earth, that these races, these ships, may come from even different planets. If that's the case, then as a scientist, I have to believe there's another way to travel. There is another way besides burning fossil fuels or burning hydrogen fuel, launching oneself at 40 or 50 or 100,000 miles an hour across space. That just takes too long. There must be a way to slide in between space, to go through a black hole, to slip into one dimension and out of another dimension, sort of like a Riemann's cut. Instead of traveling the long way around the paper, you just simply slide through the cut from one side to the other. There must be a way to accomplish this. And I don't know if we have the answer yet, but I can tell you I have a 1995 issue of Time magazine, and the title on it is When Did the Universe Begin? The questions that they ask in this article, and one of the things that they mention is the fact that, quote, supercomputers were just becoming available at that time, having enough computing power to keep up with the data coming in from these craft and from the Hubble telescope, which had been launched about that time. And now here we are 10 years later, and the computers we have today make the computers that we had in 1995 look like a wristwatch. I dare say that many of our listeners are sitting there listening to this radio broadcast on a machine that has a 2 gigahertz clock speed, with 512 meg of RAM and 160 gig hard drives, with a 19-inch color monitor. Not only can they multitask, but if they wanted to, they could join all of their computers together and exceed the computing power of even a Cray supercomputer. Now, that being said, I'd venture to say that the bandwidth that the average or even the top-end listener has is maybe 3 megabytes per second. I am cursed with dial up here in dark sky country, so I sit here at 52 kilobytes per second. But that is nothing. Nothing. My friend at Oak Ridge, his responsibility is to oversee internet communications. I can't tell you who he works for. I can't tell you his first name is Shane. His bandwidth? 3.5 gigabytes. Yes, that's his internet bandwidth. Can you imagine what he can look at? Can you imagine how much information he can look at simultaneously? You think your T1 or your T3 or your DSL moves right along? You want to see what a 3.5 gig connection can do for you. And I don't think he has the fastest connection, but he has one of the fastest over there. So I can tell you, Earth explorers, the information is out there. And there are those that are, they have changed their lives. Our next guest, his name is Dr. Stephen Greer. He is the founder of the Disclosure Project. For those of you not familiar with it, you need to go to disclosureproject.com. Follow the link at our website, X-Squared Radio, x2-radio.com, or you can just punch it into your search engine. You will find at that website, starting with the May of 2001 C-SPAN broadcast, you will find the boldest, the absolute boldest public disclosure of UFO evidence in history. And you just scratched the surface. Dr. Greer is a medical doctor. He's an emergency room physician. He felt so moved by the need for the public to know what the government knows about UFOs that he took his money and he took his ability to manage information and to bring people together and to inspire others, and he formed the Disclosure Project. His group is very large. They are very well tooled. Their job is to try, as best as I can understand their mission, to try to inform the public as well as they can so that the public, through a groundswell of what many call the silent or a bloodless revolution, where the people as a whole just step forward and say, okay, we've had enough of these black projects. We've had enough of hiding behind this veil of secrecy. We want you to open the vaults. We want you to open the cellars, open the dungeons, open the hangars. We want to see what you have. At this point, really, what would it hurt? Do you think a moment that if they hauled one of the Roswell spacecraft, or maybe one of the other spacecraft that they've got hangered away, if they hauled it out onto a tarmac and let CNN and Fox News and ABC and NBC and CBS bring their cameras down upon it and touch it and film it and show it to people, do you actually think we would panic? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think we would take a mighty sigh of relief and we would say, finally, finally, the truth has come out. Well, my friend, you'll have the chance to call in. I want you to call in if you've had a UFO experience. I want you to call in if you've got something hidden away in your cellar that you want us to send people to your house and help you disclose it and protect you. I want you to call in if you believe that the government should release what they know. The toll-free number that you can call in is 888-268-4313. That's 888-268-4313. As we wind up this hour, I want you to know that for the next year, we will dedicate at least one show a month, perhaps two, to this effort of getting this UFO information disclosed. Now, that being said, there's an ocean of fraud out there. Mountains and mountains of fraud. People who say they've seen things and they have no evidence. People dreaming up things for their own personal fame. We're looking for hard evidence. We're looking for a piece of metal, a piece of glass, a circuit board, a bone, anything, anything. If they're here and if they're as common as aircraft, and if they're flying in and out of neighborhoods all over the country. Now, I don't want you to go out and shoot one down. But if you're communicating with one, if you have relations with off-worlders, I want you to tell them the time is now to come forth because X Squared Radio is here and we will get the truth out. We will take a really short break, about 1.5 minutes, and then we will bring Dr. Stephen Greer on. Don't forget that you can pick up your copy of The Ark of Millions of Years, the national bestseller on the creation of the Earth. And I'm the physicist on it. My co-author, E.J. Clark, is the archaeologist on it. 530 pages of excellent, excellent writing and irrefutable documentation on the creation of the Earth. You can pick it up at arcofmillionsofyears.com, or you can pick it up off the shelf at your local Barnes & Noble or Davis Kidd Booksellers or Joseph Beth Booksellers. And we'll be back in about 1 minute. We have on the line with us Dr. Stephen Greer, founder and leader of the Disclosure Project. How are you, Dr. Greer?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. You know, I along with tens of thousands of others, have watched your work for many years. I know I got home one evening from my engineering position, and I turned on C-SPAN, and I saw what still remains as the most incredible public disclosure of UFO evidence I have ever seen.
Well, thank you.
And I have constantly gone back to your website, disclosureproject.com, and I've been to several MUFON conventions.
Actually, it's disclosureproject.org. If you go to COM, I don't think it goes anywhere. We're, since we're a nonprofit, it's a ORG at the end.
Ah, my mistake.
Just to clarify.
All right.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Just to clarify it. Yeah.
Disclosureproject.org.
Right.
Very good. Well, anyway, I've been to MUFON conventions where your representatives have given updates, and it's hardly an event goes by that you don't try to collect the legitimate evidence and put it on your website, and I commend you for that highly.
Well, thank you. Yeah, well, actually, we almost have too much of it. You know, people, I'm always briefing folks who say, where's the evidence that this could possibly be true? And I said, well, how much time do you have to review it? We're now pushing over 5,000 pages of government documents, and we now have identified over 450 military and intelligence and corporate witnesses to projects and events related to this. And, of course, these are people who are, it's not like a 60 Minutes thing on CBS where they have a fuzzy ball in front of the face and, all kinds of fraudulent documents or what have you. These are people who are name, rank, serial number, and who have, and in many cases still have top secret clearances, who are very concerned about a sort of rogue, illegal secret operation that has bypassed the legitimate rule of law and the legitimate government of not only the United States, but of Canada and Great Britain and other countries.
So is there this a bureaucratic government that sort of takes hundreds of billions of dollars of funding, and they basically do with it what they want as far as researching or hiding away UFO evidence, or even interacting with off-world races and not telling us what's going on?
Well, I think one of the best ways to understand it is if people look at the frontispiece of this book of testimony of military witnesses to this that we have, and it's also on our website at disclosureproject.org, is what Senator Inouye said back during the Iran-Contra hearings when he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said basically there exists a shadow government with its own air force, its own fundraising mechanism beyond the law and above the law itself. And this is something that Eisenhower, back in when he left office in January of 1961, warned the American people. And a lot of people wondered why a conservative Republican two-term president, who was a five-star general, made the comment about warning us about the excesses of the military-industrial complex. And, of course, he wasn't talking about all the military and all the industrial contractors, but that there was this large, well-funded, super-secret entity that Brigadier General Lovkin, who was a young aide to Eisenhower back then and who's one of our witnesses, said basically had stabbed President Eisenhower in the back and shoved him aside of the necessary supervisory oversight of these sort of super-secret projects related to UFOs, advanced energy and propulsion systems, including so-called anti-gravity or electrogravitic and magnetogravitic systems, as well as the actual, contact and what have you. So this is one of the real tragedies of the last 50 years of American and world history that most people aren't aware of, that there has been this sort of a rogue element that really has, and it's transnational. A lot of people think it's American. It is not. It's transnational. They don't even observe national boundaries. But they have enormous wealth and power. And, back in 1994, after I personally briefed President Clinton's first CIA director, R. James Woolsey, what was interesting is I was invited to meet with the senior counsel for the Senate Appropriations Committee. And this gentleman had a top secret clearance and also subpoena power on behalf of the Senate Appropriations Committee, which at the time was headed by Senator Byrd of West Virginia. And this gentleman told me that he had not been able to penetrate those projects but saw evidence that they were there. And he turned to me and he says, there's somewhere upwards of $100 billion a year being siphoned out of the U.S. Treasury that they cannot account for going into those kind of projects. And then he looked me right in the eye and he said, Dr. Greer, you're dealing with the varsity team of all covert black projects. He says, good luck. And it was a very sobering sort of meeting on the heels of this three-hour meeting I had with a sitting CIA director on this problem.
Well, there are several things that kind of sober us up as the public when we ask the question, why? There's really three categories that it could fall into. One is, they're doing this for our own protection. They don't want to cause general panic. The second is that they have some kind of socioeconomic relationship with the off-worlders, if they do exist, and they don't want to involve the general public in that. And the third would be that there are national security interests that they believe that they are or could be hostile, and then at some point in the future that they'll have to defend the planet against them?
Well, it's none of the above, and this is the thing that shocks most people. You know, when I meet with people who are senators and other folks, I'm calling right now at this moment from Washington D.C., and I'm looking right at the Capitol dome from my townhouse here in Washington. And what's interesting is when you talk to these people, and I will say to them what I'm going to say to you, and they look at me and they say, "I have no doubt that's true." I say, "Look, you're dealing with a kleptocracy that is trying to preserve someone's $200 trillion piggy bank consisting of oil, gas, coal, nuclear power, and linear energy generation systems. It has nothing to do with the national security of the United States. It has nothing to do with the fact that there might be hostile interests out in space. It certainly doesn't have to do that they have some kind of secret agreement with off-world people." This is, those are all cover stories put out there to explain something, you know, what Dr. Bearden and I talked about, something much more prosaic. And that is, you're talking about the mother of all special interests and cartels, who, if the information was confirmed that UFOs were real, that extraterrestrial propulsion systems had been studied for at least 50 or 60 and maybe 70 years or longer, and that we had figured out how they operate, at least by the 50s and perhaps earlier, that what this means is that all the fossil fuels in the world are redundant, and they only have utility for petrochemicals and lubricants and things of this sort. So you're talking about something that had obviously a huge economic impact, but that, you know, in terms of the tide that would lift all nations and all peoples to bring out a source of energy and a source of propulsion that would get us off of the earth-destroying myth called oil and coal and would lift all the world's population out of poverty. A lot of people forget that 80% of the world's population is living in unbelievable poverty, and that if more than about 20 or 30% of the world lived like you and I do, we'd be out of oil, and we'd, you know, the price of a gallon of gasoline would be up over $10 or $15 a gallon very quickly, just because of the supply-demand imbalance.
And we'd probably all have to wear gas masks if we were outside.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, long before we run out of oil, we would have ended up melting both polar ice caps and causing all kinds of other problems. But the point is that you're dealing with something here that's in the sense, the mother of all special interests. And what they have done is that they have conflated their economic and geopolitical power interests with national security interests. And it's a little bit like the canard of, you know, it's like the kind of person who wraps themselves in the Bible or wraps themselves in the flag, when really what they're wanting to do is something very self-aggrandizing. So, you know, I think it's a much more, in a sense, prosaic and understandable reason for the secrecy, is that you're stepping on the 10,000-pound King Kong's toes when you talk about bringing out information that would lead, perforce, to the disclosure of the energy and propulsion behind these things. Because anyone with anyone who's not brain dead, if they hear these things are real, one of the first things they ask is that, well, gee, you know, how are they traveling through interstellar distances? What kind of energy system are they using? Obviously, they're not bringing Exxon Jet A fuel on board, or even liquid hydrogen or anything else. And so then that question will get answered, because those answers are out there. And when that gets answered, you know, as the old REM song goes, it's the end of the world as we know it. I mean, you're talking about a complete change in geopolitics and in macroeconomic systems that would make the Industrial Revolution of the mid-1800s look like a minor blip on the radar screen of human civilization's evolution. So this is a very, very big issue. I'm not trying to trivialize it. I'm just trying to say that, you know, understanding the dynamic of it, you really have to get down to the basics of why people would slap secrecy and create so much disinformation and confusion around the subject. And you really have to cut through an enormous amount of noise to get to the sound at the center of this whole issue.
Yes, yes. And we've covered some of the things like that on this program. For instance, nobody believes that somebody jumps in a metal can 50 light years away and travels at the speed of light for 50 years to get here.
Right, exactly.
And if the speed of light travel is even possible to us, it's, you know, superluminal drive is something you see in science fiction movies. But in order for the plethora of craft, and I don't mean just a single type of craft, all kinds of different craft come here, it appears, there must be a way to travel these vast distances across space or even in between
right.
space besides throwing ions out the pack in and going in the other direction.
Well, you know, this is what important, you know, we have several people I'm working with who are at a meeting with Ben Rich, who used to be head of Lockheed Skunk Works. And, you know, he said after a lecture he gave in Southern California towards the end of his career, to about 15 people standing around him, he said, you know, he said three things that were very interesting. The first thing he said was that, you know, there are no private conversations anywhere on Earth at this point. The second thing he said was that we, meaning at Lockheed Skunk Works, we already have technologies and the means to travel among the stars faster than the speed of light, but that those were locked away in ultra-secret projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity, and it's a crying shame. He lamented that. The third thing he said was that anything you can imagine, we've already done at Lockheed Skunk Works. I mean, like literally, I mean, just extraordinary things. And I remind people that one of our witnesses was an Air Force person in Canada, actually, at this old Toronto Air Station outside Toronto in the 50s. And in 1953, they were doing some electronic and electromagnetic experimentation, and he came across this experiment at this facility where they could literally take a solid object, say a glass object, and quote-unquote dematerialize it and move it into another room and take it back and forth all through electronics. This was over 50 years ago, 52 years ago. So, and I have other reports from similar people. So a lot of people go, oh, come on, you can't imagine we were doing those sort of things half a century ago, and we're still burning for 57% of our electricity in the United States coal like we were in the 1800s. I said, yeah, well, that's what it's about. So, you know, this whole issue, now obviously there are other issues as well around the secrecy. What would the Orthodox religious people think if it came out that, you know, humans aren't the only intelligent life forms in the world? Well, the fact of the matter is I've had high-level meetings at the Vatican, and the folks there go, yeah, well, we accept that that's true, and we view them all as children of God. But you have a small 10-20% of fanatics who would say, oh, you know, it's like the Flat Earth Society. You know, at the end of the world, if it were to acknowledge that there's intelligent life somewhere outside the biosphere of Earth. So, you know, there are all these sort of issues that do begin to get involved in the secrecy. But the central reason for it is macroeconomic, geopolitical power and those issues. And, of course, they'll use those issues, these special interests, and not acknowledge them. And then they'll say, oh, well, it's something that's very brave. And, you know, there's this threat. Well, you know, what threat? You know, I told people, I said, if there was any threat from outer space, given the fact that we have been using advanced so-called scalar electromagnetic or longitudinal weapon systems to target these objects for at least 50 years, and on a number of occasions have actually downed these objects because they're very electronic in their control and command systems. You know, the level of technology that these extraterrestrial life forms have, if they were hostile to us, you and I wouldn't be having this conversation. It would have been point, set, match, probably 50 to 60 years ago.
Yeah, so, sort of,
you know,
like
I think there's a lot of sort of nonsense and xenophobia and sort of saber rattling and fear mongering that is used as a cover for the real reason for the secrecy, which unfortunately is as old as mankind, and it has to do with power and greed and maintaining the status quo of people's cartels and interests.
Oh, that's exactly right. And these macroeconomic control systems have been in place in several dynasties throughout time, the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman
right.
Empire. But those things were always taken apart by uncontrolled dissemination of pure knowledge to people. And then
that's
smart people get hold of it.
And that's why we think this is so important to do.
Right, exactly.
You know, a lot of people think what we're doing is very futuristic, I'll be honest with you. And I say, no. Well, what we're dealing with is stuff that should have been disclosed, known, and have become a routinized aspect of our society before I was born in 1955. All right? So my point to people is that we're playing catch up here. We're about 50 years, maybe 60 years off of our natural evolutionary path. And that's why we're now seeing such enormous geopolitical pressures and physical pressures with global warming and the problem with the pollution. And, you know, of course, the Japan and China about to go to blows over oil in the China Sea and all these sort of things. It's because we've really overstayed the fossil fuel, quote unquote, game by several decades. And if we had been wise during the era of the late Truman and Eisenhower years, we would have transitioned out of that smokestack economy to a true high-tech economy. And what I tell people is that, we have cell phones, we have fiber optics, we have integrated circuits and computers, supercomputers, but that's all being powered off of coal and fossil fuel most of the time. So on one hand, we think we're very high-tech, but in reality, if you take a step back, we're really retarded about 100 years or 50 years. And our civilization is beginning to strain under that unnatural sort of holding back of what our evolutionary path can be and should have been. So what I view ourselves as doing is that we're simply trying to correct an imbalance, bring things back on track, bring this knowledge out, and bring, we hope, the technologies out with it, and move society forward into its next chapter of development.
Well, let me ask you the question of all questions then.
Sure.
What will it take? What will it take to get this kind of energy revolution happening?
Well, I think, and this is what we're working on with a startup sort of effort that's very modest, is that we're trying to identify scientists who understand the physics behind these things so that we could build a proof of principle, robust, not something in the milliwatt range, but maybe a kilowatt range, a so-called, quote-unquote, free energy or quantum vacuum energy generation system that we could then bring out to the public. Like with the Disclosure Project, you have to remember, that was carried on every network in the world. Our website has had over 10 million people on it. More than 3 million people have seen the entire two-hour press conference. If we had something that would operate under those conditions, we would have 10 times that amount of interest, because there are going to be 10 times more people interested in the environmental and energy consequences of that development than, say, the UFO question per se. So I think that that's what we're working on now and focusing on. And I put out a call to all people out there listening that if they can help us develop that, where they want to do it anonymously, confidentially, or however they want to do it, that is the next thing. And I will tell you, I have had meetings with members of the Congress who are on the House Energy Committee, people on the House National Security Committee, Senate Intelligence Committee, and these people who are friendly to what we want to do, but are a bit scared of the issue, have told me, you got to bring out the science. You got to bring out one, even if it's just a generation 1.0 version of what maybe Lockheed has as generation 200, that this would be not only prove the science, but it would open that whole door. And it would not only open the door scientifically as a proof of the energy system, but it would also then begin to create a whole new technology and industry that could also fund, I have to point this out, the disclosure of the truth about many other related issues that have been kept secret. You can't do that. You know, a lot of people look at the Disclosure Project and they think we have millions of dollars. I said, oh my God. I said, we did all of that with a $150,000 gift from primarily one benefactor who's a fellow emergency doctor, a friend of mine. I'm a trauma physician, left my career to do this, and our biggest supporter is another doctor who's a working girl. You know, it's a woman who's just fantastic. But, you know, there has not been the kind of financial support necessary to really do that. And we're looking for that, but it's got to be clean money. It can't, be money that has a bunch of corrupt strings attached to it, which is why, of course, we've been offered that and we won't do it. I'd rather be poor and have my integrity than to have, $1 billion and then sell out to these rogue.
Agreed. But, well, I know the producer site upon which my radio program is listed sees about 14 million visits a week.
Right.
So we have not only a tremendous amount of listeners that listen live and are listening right now, but we also have them that come back and listen to the archives over and over again, and this is going to be one that's going to be main listed.
Well, that's wonderful. I appreciate any support like that we can get. And, we are the Disclosure Project, a nonprofit, and we have sustained this effort through just really modest and in times of fairly, mid-sized gifts from folks who really understand what's at stake here. We're really not talking about something where we're tinkering around the edges of the problems facing humanity. This is just one of the most central issues that are holding human evolution back, but also damaging our biosphere and really causing us to be faced with what I call a terminal civilization. We do not have the means right now to support 6, 7, 10 billion people on the planet, depleting these sort of natural resources, living the way we are today on the Earth. But with these technologies that we're talking about and this knowledge knowledge we're talking about, we could have a sustainable civilization on Earth that would go on for thousands of years with homeostasis and balance with the environment and with the Earth. So I think that, you know, it's a vision of where humanity can go, and it's not something that's based in sort of like dreamland. This is doable, but we're going to have to unite and really, really do some seriously hard work, both in the scientific and technology areas, but also in the social and cultural and political and media areas to get the information out.
Well, I know prior to this broadcast, a couple of weeks ago, one of your staff members sent me some blueprints and photographs of a prototype of an energy device, which I can certainly build. I don't have any problem building it, and I may do that this year.
Well, folks like you, we need all the help we can get. We appreciate it. We have no doubt that if we can get something that would prove the science. Now, we have seen some things that are more primitive that do not have, unfortunately, enough robust power behind them. You know, if something is in the milliwatt range or a couple of, this isn't going to impress anyone. But if you can create something that you can show will, you know, run a kilowatt or two or five, that can then be scalable, and you can say, look, this can begin to take our civilization to a new level of functioning. And I have to point out, it isn't just about energy and money. It's a new paradigm in thinking. Imagine what would happen around the world if people had a source of energy for free in terms of cost, the price of the energy per se, of desalinization of water. So you had potable water and water for irrigation of crops. Imagine what you could do with land utilization if you had this kind of energy. Propulsion, if you have the electrogravitic system. And a lot of people say, well, couldn't those be used for weapons? I say, yeah, but they already are. The worst elements possible have already weaponized this stuff.
Yeah.
And are holding people.
Look who's been funding the construction and research.
People laugh. I said, I have personally done briefings for the head of intelligence, for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they are very worried that there is a shadowy group that have technology that can trump them. You know, I mean, this is a serious problem. So, I always laugh when people bring up that as the sort of an issue. I go, come on, the worst possible elements of our society already have these technologies.
Well, not only that, I don't think there's a human alive, a sentient being alive, that doesn't believe that the race is on the verge of a metamorphosis. We are,
correct.
We are almost to the point where we can lay arms down and not fight each other anymore. We have to provide two things to everyone alive on the earth today. We have to provide them access to energy and access to capital.
Right.
And if we continue to hoard things and I know it goes beyond imagination. I can't imagine a single person being worth $40 or $50 or $100 billion. I heard the other day the Olsen twins were worth $80 billion.
Right.
I see, the other 80% of the planet that makes $3,000 a year and all the potatoes they can carry home during harvest time.
Right.
If you have, and one of the things I noticed when I traveled around the world, and I was in Mexico City last month and some of the areas, outlying areas, is the way we transmit energy around this planet across wires, over poles, and like you say, we spin steam turbines by heating it up with coal or heating it up with nuclear power or natural gas. It's primitive.
Oh, it's very primitive. Yeah.
And if we had a standalone,
very primitive,
clean energy system that would spin a turbine or just generate electricity,
right?
Then all these transmission lines go away. And now you have small communities that are self-sustaining. They can pump their own water. They can irrigate their own fields. They can power their own medical clinics. Now you've changed the face of the world. Now there is
really
no reason.
And power, it's interesting, not only power in the figurative sense, but literal power would become at this village level. In other words, you look at the subcontinent of India. And it's a multi-trillion-dollar task for them to electrify India just to put the grid up and the power plants, transmission lines, distribution. This would enable so much of the world to go basically bypass the smokestack level of development that the West has gone through from the mid-1800s to now. And it's almost like when you go to some of those areas of the world where they bypass regular phone lines, and everyone's talking off of a cell phone, took wireless, that you basically would move society to that level, and you would have a world of very prosperous villages. And not only would there be a decentralization of literal power and electricity and energy generation, but to be a decentralization of figurative power. Now, this is the one thing that they don't want to happen, though, when you think about it, because right now there's about 200 or 300 individuals and interlocking corporations that control the vast majority of all the assets on Earth, not only economic assets, but commodities and other things.
Agreed.
And this is, and that's, a lot of people don't realize that, but that is a true statement, what I just said. And that is what, and it, to me, it's genuinely a spiritual sickness. You know, I have been with a few billionaires, and many of them will say, yeah, well, this is great, but I have to keep what I have, and, you know, I can't support what you're doing. Why don't you go talk to someone? I only have $10 billion, but Joe Schmo has $20 billion. So it almost becomes a spiritual illness where if people just want to hoard, as you use that very good word, hoard power and money. And it's not money the way you and I think of it. I think of money, gee, I've got four daughters to put through college. It's money in the sense that it represents enormous power. Let's look, after you have a certain number of amount of money and you have 10 homes and 20 jets and whatever, it's not about money, it's about the power. And it really is almost a spiritual crisis in the world today where there's so much enormous poverty, and yet there are these centers of enormous power and wealth, and they don't want to let that change. So it's a paradigm, both spiritual and cultural and scientific, that has to shift into this new metamorphosis of a concept of how humans can live together.
Well, I believe, as you do, that information and the dissemination of good, true, usable information to develop these energy systems, propulsion systems, communication systems, will change the race of man. I think that we may even transcend the need for war if we can reach this point.
Absolutely. I think that is the inevitable outcome of this. And I point out to people that the technologies are extant today to enable us to monitor and ensure that any of these technological developments are used only for peaceful purposes. And if they're not, it can be stopped. You know, this is another mistake. You know, a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, you really can't control that. Believe me, if we wanted to, we can. We keep the fire burning, and there are elements burning, because let's not forget, you're dealing with a $1 trillion military-industrial laboratory complex on the Earth today. It last year just surpassed $1 trillion. So that's a lot of money. I mean, you know, the World Economic Outlook is whatever, 30-some trillion, but still $1 trillion a year, every year. This is another big economic and power center. And, you know, I mean, I had one general say to me, you know, God, heaven forbid the peace would break out. But, you know, most don't feel that way, actually.
Did my producer beat me that we have a caller on the line?
Again.
Yes, do we have a caller on the line?
Yes.
Yes, what was your question?
I just called in to let you know I sent a video of a UFO flying from behind a hill behind a pickup truck.
Okay.
Wanted them to view that. And,
all right, we'll view it.
Oh, I'd love to see it. Send it to us. Send a copy to us. It'd be great to see that.
I sent it.
The other thing that people have asked is, like, would you, where are all the images? I have hundreds and hundreds of, not fake, but authentic images of these objects, some of which are man-made. Now, this is the other thing that people have to understand, is that not everything that goes a bump in the night is you know, what they think it is. There are disc and triangular-shaped craft that are made by a consortium of companies that includes Lockheed Martin, Northrop, and SAIC, and a few other companies that look like what people would call a UFO. And in a sense, because they're unidentified to the person looking at it, is a UFO.
But they're not extraterrestrial.
I try to distinguish between the two categories. One is, are what I call ETV.
Are we still together?
The term used there, an extraterrestrial vehicle. The other one is an ARV, what's been called an ARV in the trade, which is an alien reproduction vehicle. And these are
things
that look like an ET craft, but they're man-made.
How about that?
Yeah, so you have to really look at these things carefully and know kind of how they're functioning. And sometimes you really can't tell which is which. You know, is it real or is it Memorex?
Caller, where are you calling from?
Broken Arrow, Oklahoma.
Oh, Oklahoma. Okay, very good. And did you send the video in?
Pardon me?
You sent the video in?
Yes.
All right. Well,
I sent it to contact@bloginservice.com.
Yes, we just received it. Thank you very much, and I will forward it on to Dr. Brooks Agnew and Dr. Greer. Thank you very much.
Right, okay, very good. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you for the call. Well, I didn't know how long you wanted to stay on. We've been on 30 minutes. I know you're on a cell phone, and I know you've got places to go and people to see, but I did want to let you know that you've got a tremendous following here in North Carolina. I live in an area that wouldn't even have electricity to this day if it wasn't for the TVA bringing electricity to the rural areas of the South.
Oh, where are you?
I'm in about 50 miles west of Charlotte.
Okay.
I can actually see the Appalachian Mountains from my home.
Oh, yeah. Well, we lived for 11 years in Asheville, North Carolina, right next to Biltmore House, so I know the area very well. I grew up in Charlotte. Charlotte is my hometown. I was born and then raised in Charlotte.
Well, I was also born in 1955, so I was born and raised in Pasadena, and I grew up, most of my friends were interns at JPL and Hughes. And,
right.
My brother is chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins, so we come from a family of explorers.
Right. Well, I do too. My uncle was the senior project engineer that designed the lunar module that took Neil Armstrong to the moon. So he was a Grumman engineer. Of course, Grumman had the contract for the LEM, the lunar module that landed on the moon initially, or at least the first acknowledged landing on the moon.
Well, that's tremendous. So we have ARVs, and then we have the extraterrestrial vehicles.
Right.
And
ARVs and ETVs, correct.
The ARVs, have we learned how to make those right-hand turns at 10,000 miles an hour?
Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely. I mean, I know folks who have piloted them, humans that have piloted them. And a lot of people don't realize, I have a photograph from 1964, broad daylight over Provo, Utah, and it's sort of near the Dugway Proving Ground, where one of these man-made ones was being test flown in 64. Well, now, you know, that's 41 years ago, almost 42 years ago. So a lot of people are very naive about the fact. They think that this is all, really a new revelation. The thing is that the mainstream media has been corrupted for decades to keep this stuff quiet. And, it's interesting. I believe to ask me what is the leading cause, the problem on getting this information out, it's the corruption of big media, not the small media, but the big so-called mainstream media. I've been involved with that level of the media for years, and it is enormously corrupt.
Yes, it is.
We have had executive producers at the highest level, for example, at ABC, who received all of the witness testimony and evidence and wanted to put it on a special, and the corporate people came in and said, no, you will not put that on. And when I asked the person, why can't you do that? I thought you had control over Primetime Live. The producer turned to me and said, well, you know what? You know why. And I said, well, who told you? And he said that you can't do that. And he says, well, Dr. Greer, you know who they are. And he says,
well, I can tell you this. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS radio. We have 26 hosts that host various shows almost 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on this network.
Right.
And I believe we have a caller on the line.
Uh-huh. Yes, hello.
Yes. Where are you calling from?
Normal, Illinois.
Normal, Illinois. What do you have for us?
I have a question for Dr. Greer. For about the last 60 years, there's been millions of sightings, and anybody who's really studied ufology, whatever, realizes there's a lot of different aliens probably visiting us. Now, my question for you is, for the Disclosure Project, what is the possibility of Earth or some nation of the Earth actually politically, diplomatically interacting with one of the many alien species that's visiting us? Obviously, the United States doesn't want to do this, but could some other nation try to actually force a relationship?
Well, absolutely. And this is your question is excellent. And the reason I got involved with this in 1990 was we founded what's called the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, CSETI. The Disclosure Project is a project of CSETI. Now, CSETI, our initial project, was that we formed diplomatic contact teams that went all over the world and made the kind of contact you're asking about. word of that got to President Clinton and to the head of Army Intelligence and to the Boutros Ghali family at the UN, and I suddenly found myself briefing these kinds of world leaders on this issue. Now, when Senator Claiborne Pell was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I said, you know what? You and people like you who could take a peaceful and diplomatic approach to this need to wrestle control of this issue and go out there and do it. But none of them ever got the courage to do it. But yes, absolutely, if Canada or any country in the world wanted to set up an interface between these civilizations themselves, we know how to do it. We have done it. We have been able to vector craft into near landing events with us, I mean literally in the field with us. And we have had hundreds, in fact, more than 1,000 people with us at various times over the last 10 or 15 years who've witnessed this. This is a very doable thing if you approach it in a peaceful and diplomatic way. Now, if you're out there with weapons drawn on them, no, they're not going to approach you. But I think this is something, your question to me is a brilliant question, because the thing that no one ever asks about is, they're out there and we're here, who's doing anything about this incipient, maybe embryonic relationship that could evolve? Well, unfortunately, because no acknowledged legal government of the world is doing anything with this, the UN isn't, I know, because I've been there briefing these folks, it is this big vacuum into which have stepped people who view the world with very paranoid, xenophobic lenses on their eyes. And so this is a very big danger about this issue, is that who's managing the relationship? And I think that it's very important that we, the citizens of the world, say, look, we should encourage this. And we're right now making entrees to leadership in Canada, for example, to brief them on this issue and hope that one country around the world that is as free as possible from the corrupting influences of the secrecy would do exactly what you're asking about. And, you know, recently, as a former Minister of Defense for Canada, Paul Hellyer, came forward talking about the fact that the UFOs were real. But back in the 60s, he actually inaugurated a UFO landing site, a contact site in Canada. Back in the 60s, this is true. Now, you know, so the potential has been there for years, but it's never been followed up on. CSETI, you can go to our website, CSETI.org, is the parent organization that started the whole disclosureproject.org effort. And it was really about making contact that was diplomatic and peaceful and opening up a dialogue with these civilizations. I have no doubt in my mind from the experiences we've had. And by the way, we do training 3 or 4 times a year where we take people who are interested in this out into the desert of Colorado or California or where have you to experiment with contact protocols to do this, because I'm convinced that we need a citizen's diplomacy effort to do this kind of contact work seriously in advance of our government or a government of the world doing it. So far, no government of the world has stepped forward to take on that kind of responsibility.
Do you think that's because
the United Nations hasn't either? When I was dealing with officials at the highest level of the Secretary General's office at the United Nations, they got very close to doing that, and then they were threatened. I was told specifically by an ambassador at large that was right hand to the Secretary General that they were told to back off of dealing with this issue, and they did. So the issue is that there's a lot of intimidation out there. This is why we need to get the public aware of this, so that when people in officialdom do step forward to do this, they will have a constituency that will say, hey, we want this to happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, we need to put a spotlight on the issue, and I think that what you're asking about is so critical because, you know, there's no question, you're right, millions of people have seen these crafts. There's no question they're out there. We can prove it. And so this begs the question, who's taking care of that relationship? We need to tend to that.
Well, there's 192 nations on the earth, and I'm surprised that some of the smaller or the weaker nations couldn't put a radio broadcast and welcome them here. I've read of other groups that actually made landing fields, but I haven't heard of anybody actually electronically trying to communicate them at an official level.
Well, and then this is the problem. I think that you have a lot of people don't know what to think about this subject. Is it real? Is it not real? This is why disclosure is so important and education is so important. You know, before someone can take the step you're talking about, they first have to be adequately briefed on the science and the facts and the evidence behind it, and then reach the conclusion, gosh, this stuff is real. Now let's do something
sane and rational about it, rather than just tracking them and blowing them out of the sky when we have an opportunity with a electromagnetic pulse weapon, which is unfortunately what's been going on for a long time. We need to have another face of humanity being shown to the cosmos.
Yes, I agree with that. And one of the questions that keeps coming up, people ask me, well, if they've been here, have we built enough of a relationship that some of us have gone there?
Well, you know, there probably have been on individual cases where perhaps that has happened. But that's, you know, idiosyncratic and individualistic. I think they're waiting. You know, this is why my analysis of all the data over the last 60 years, I believe that there are multiple extraterrestrial civilizations that have been observing this planet for a very long time.
I agree.
Maybe thousands of years, certainly over 100. And since the dawn of the nuclear and space age and this sort of like coinciding of our ability to develop the world-destroying weapons, such as hydrogen bombs and worse, at the same time that we're beginning to go into space, that there became a very big red flag that rose over planet Earth. And they have been waiting for humans to begin to live together in a mature and civilized way with each other, but also to approach them in a mature and civilized way. And we haven't done it. And I think this is one of the real shortcomings of the last 50 to 100 years of human history that's not been talked about. And I'll never forget having this conversation with Senator Claiborne Pell. I was out at a briefing for a board of directors that he was on, and we were right next to George Lucas's ranch out in San Rafael, California. And my wife and I went out with Senator Pell on a patio, and he was asking me about this issue. He says, you know, I've been on every committee in the Congress, and every time we've inquired about this, they've been told us that nothing exists, and they just lie to us. I said, yes, sir, I know. I've already briefed the CIA director, and they're lying to him, too, so you're in good company. That's what I told him. And he looked at me, and you know, he says, well, would you come and brief my staff on this? I said, oh, yeah, I'd be happy to, Senator. And then I looked at him, and I said, you know what? It's a crying shame, but here you are. You sort of epitomize noblesse oblige. A very enlightened in it. And you and those like you have been deprived of dealing with the ultimate foreign relations issue. And I pointed to the stars above our head. And he looked at me through his horn-rimmed glasses and blinked and said, well, Dr. Greer, I'm afraid you might be right. I said, well, I am. I mean, it was a very poignant moment. You know, here is this very esteemed member of the U.S. Senate who had been there since, I don't know, the 50s or something. And people like him could do exactly what this caller is asking about, but have never been able to get their questions answered. And this is why disclosing the facts of this and the truth about this is so important at this time in history.
Well, one of the points that I wanted to make, and I don't mean to be brash, I don't mean to be condescending, but why is it that we think that it must be a government official, a senator, a president, a governor, that has to step forth and say, you know, welcome to the earth, I'm going to be your ambassador? Why can't it just be John Q. Public, somebody in Oklahoma or Colorado or New Mexico or Africa?
That's what we're doing. And, you know, if you get on the CSETI site, we literally have these working groups, these contact groups that are in every nation in the world almost right now. And, you know, we train people to do this, and they're going out, and you know what? They're having amazing contact experiences. I mean, I'm not kidding. So, I mean, I tell people that this is doable, and it doesn't have to be the president. But at a certain point, when you have a huge, powerful infrastructure that's out of control, something that could harm this relationship through the militarization of it and the militarization of space and the weaponization of space, you need to have the representatives of the people that have the official status to step in and help. And that's where it does become important. It's not an either-or question. And since 1990, CSETI, the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence, we have been training people to do exactly what you said, everyday people, housewives, farmers, rocket scientists, the whole, you know, gamut, to do exactly that and go out and make this kind of contact and show a different side of the human face to the cosmos. But at the same time, we also need to recognize that those people who have the responsibility of the leadership of this planet and need to be educated, need to be informed, and need to be encouraged to do the right thing. It isn't an either-or thing. I see the sort of citizen's diplomacy that we're doing as something that creates, if you understand Sheldrake's morphogenic fields and the sort of non-local propagation of knowledge and events, it sort of sets up the, or sows the seeds for what can be a successful future, more official, large-scale contact. And that's really what we're doing with SeaCity.
And that's when everything changes.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's like the hunter's monkey effect.
I believe you have a caller on the line. Where are you calling from?
Yes, I'm calling from Florida here.
Oh, okay. What's your question?
I've been reading on the website about this sepo.org. I don't know if Dr. Greer know about this one here. Does he have any comment on that?
I couldn't understand. What.org?
Serpo, I believe it's SERPO.org.
No, I'm not familiar.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that either. Go ahead, though. What's your question?
Well, they were talking about a project they did back in the 50s or 60s, I believe, to send humans out to a planet called Serpo, and they had an kind of exchange there. I didn't know if Dr. Greer knew about that one.
I'm not saying it has or hasn't happened. I'm not familiar with it, and I've seen no data to support that it has, but certainly it's possible. You know, there's a lot of history here that has not been published, but I'm not familiar with that particular initiative.
I see. If you do get a chance, I think it may be worth it to take a look at it. It's serpo.org.
Yeah, go ahead and send the link to us at info@x2-radio.com, and I'll check it out and disseminate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call.
Okay, appreciate it. Bye.
Well, I can't tell you the calls that I get, the mail that I get, the mail that you get, the fever that has been building over the years. You're so immersed in it. You've dedicated your life to it. You've given up your regular career for this. There are many of us that are just kind of getting caught in the wave now, and we want to apply our know-how, our engineering skills, our ability to build equipment, our ability to do research, and also our dollars, because we want to see this happen. This is not something that we should take lightly. We are immersed in this sort of a science fiction world. I don't think there's 10% of this country that doesn't believe UFOs don't exist.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that we've seen a live craft on CNN or Fox News sitting on the White House lawn with being shaking hands with the president either.
Right.
But that's almost what it will take to get some people to say, okay, I believe they exist. I mean, there are some people that don't believe we went to the moon still.
Oh, sure. And there's still the Flat Earth Society, for that matter. And there are people who think that the Earth is 6,000 years old. But you're right. The majority of people do think that there's something to this, and that there are covert programs hiding the truth. Well, in excess of 50% in Harris polls and other polls have supported that. And what I say to people is that, look, you know, we need to combine together and bring as much of the facts. And this is why I'm always saying, anyone who's going to help us with the science behind these technologies and help us create one of these prototypes of an energy or propulsion device, they should contact us at disclosureproject.org. And anyone who is either a witness to these sort of projects or events while they were in the government or Air Force or military or corporation who wants to help get information to us that we can still get out to the public, they should feel free to contact me, because we are wanting to identify as many and a growing number of these sort of witnesses as possible. Now, with that said, you know, we already have about 110 of these top secret witnesses on videotape, and if you get, we have a book called Disclosure that's a series of transcripts and government documents and interviews with these people that are named, but these are all named military and corporate and intelligence witnesses and government witnesses, and it's about 600 pages. You can get it on our website, disclosureproject.org, but we want to continue that because there's credibility in numbers, there's safety in numbers, and there's the ability to get more and more people will be emboldened to come forward and speak the truth when other people do it. Because, you know, it's one of these subjects that, you know, there's a lot of kind of giggle factor and what have you when you bring up the UFO and extraterrestrial issue. But if you have more and more people with credibility and with these sort of bona fides come forward and say, look, you know, I was a Strategic Air Command and we tracked this thing going, whatever. It becomes real for people, and then it encourages more people to talk about it, more people to bring it up to their representative, more people to bring it up within their scientific circles, and we hope eventually into the fundraising sector where there can be enough financial support to get only not only the technologies out, but the information out.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Well, can you tell us in the next 3 months where you're going to be appearing, where people can access you in person or some of your representatives or some of your events in the next 3 months?
Well, they should get to our website. These things get scheduled pretty, not real short notice, but fairly short notice, both with all the other projects I'm working at. I will say that usually every summer we do one of these expeditions in Colorado in the San Luis Valley, where many of these UFOs and ET craft have been seen. We'll be doing that again this coming year. We also go up on Mount Shasta and do an expedition in around Labor Day. In November, we take people who want to come out with us up out into the Joshua Tree Wilderness later in the fall. And we do other expeditions. And, of course, periodically, I do appear at different conferences and give lectures live. But I would say that you know, once people, you know, they can get on our website and then just sign on so that they can be notified when we are having an event in their area, and we'll notify them.
Very good. Excellent. And we have one more call that we can take. Is there a caller on the line?
Yes.
And where are you calling from?
Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. This is Art again. I have a question for Dr. Greer.
Okay.
Dr. Greer, I was a state field investigator, state section director for MUFON for several years in this area. I've dropped out of it since. But how do you have, could you briefly explain a field way to contact UFOs should somebody be out and see one? Do you have a brief explanation on how to contact them?
Yes, actually, it's interesting. We have a whole series of protocols, experimental, that we've been using, and it's called the CE5 initiative, or Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. It's a term that I coined, and then Dr. Haynes wrote a whole book about it. And a close encounter of the fifth kind is basically when a human either sees one of these objects, and instead of just looking at it passively, makes the step to signal to it. And you can do it with a flashlight, a laser, as long as you do it safely. We have also used, we have electronic tones that were recorded from one of these objects that we then electronically send out with a radio transceivers. And we also use what's called coherent thought. Now, this gets very controversial. But, you know, when I was meeting with the CIA director, his wife, who was at the time head of the National Academy of Sciences, she was chief operating officer, Dr. Woolsey, turned to me and she says, how are these things communicating in real time across these interstellar distances? And I said, well, they're not using an FM radio.
Exactly.
And I said, you know, you have to understand that very advanced technologies, when they resonate at frequencies faster than the speed of light, all right, and it's really wrong to say faster because it's not what it does. It's actually a different spectrum. They interface with what used to be called the etheric area of energy, which interfaces with consciousness and thought. And so if you look if you do an ethnography across many societies, many people will report seeing one of these extraterrestrial life forms holding a device that is somehow communicating with them, where they're literally having a thought in their head. They're not hearing it through the audible, but it's, and people say, well, is that telepathic? I think, yeah, but not the way you think of it. It's high-tech telepathy in the sense that it is a type of what I call consciousness-assisted technology and technology-assisted consciousness. There's two things, one running one way, one running the other. But without getting too arcane here to answer your question, but the technology-assisted consciousness sort of devices that are out there that these extraterrestrial civilizations use allow them to pick up on an individual or a small group's coherently directed thought. So we use both tones, electromagnetic signals, lights, and also coherent thought to do this. And I recommend if people are in an area where these objects are being seen, if they go out as a group in a coherent way and practice these protocols, they'll be surprised to how easy it is to actually interact with these objects and actually make contact. We've been doing this for 15 years, and like I said, literally thousands of people have seen this happen in real time. A lot lot of people said, boy, now this is really way out stuff. I said, yeah, well, you're not dealing with your granddad's Oldsmobile, and you're not dealing with Thomas Edison's electromagnetic technologies either.
Well, it's not really way out stuff. We have documentable proof of remote viewing. In physics, we have a phenomenon called entangled particles, where we can separate an electron with a specific spin from a molecule, and they have been separated as far as 11 kilometers away.
Correct.
And then the spin of that electron has been changed, and instantaneously its partner electron, still back on that molecule 11 kilometers away, changes spin instantaneously, far faster than the speed of light.
That's right. So you're dealing with the area of what I call non-locality, and the fact that when you what I call the crossing point of light, or the so-called electromagnetic spectrum, we think that's a barrier. It is not. And if you're dealing with civilizations that are traveling at superluminal velocities, they also have communication systems that are similarly phasing, if you will, or resonating within that spectrum of the cosmology. And that enables them to interface with thought and consciousness. And so, you know, even though that sounds really far out to a lot of people, what I have to say is, hey, step back from our current technologies and show somebody a cell phone who happened to live in the time of Thomas Jefferson or the Salem witch trials. You'd be burned at the stake.
Yes, you would.
So, you know, what looks like magic to one people is a routine thing. I mean, to us, we just, you know, talk on cell phones and on, you know, satellite TV. That would look like magic to someone even 150 or 200 years ago. So we're dealing with civilizations that are 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th years, 100,000 to maybe a million years or more, scientifically and culturally more developed than we are. And so it makes sense that they would have technologies that are at this cutting edge of what you just referred to very properly as what we're beginning to discover through very good science that's been done on this.
Very good.
Well, it looks like it's going to be left up to somebody like you, Dr. Gripp, because I remember President Bush during one of his campaign appearances, one of the reporters asked him if he was going to be able to find out about the mystery or what's going on behind UFOs, and he has yet to say anything in that regard.
You know, what he said was, well, I think that Dick Cheney would know more about that. You should ask him.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Griffin, and good luck in your endeavors, and
thanks
for the information.
All right. And I will let you go. It's been 1 hour, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming on the program. We'll have you on again.
I appreciate that. I appreciate your support and your networking help for us.
No problem. And I will continue to send people to your website. I'll correctly link that on the front of our webpage. And I'll follow, as I always do, your activities, and I'll email you from time to time, and I'm going to become skilled and try to get some of my group skilled on this CE5 protocol.
That'd
and
be
great. We're going to try it.
And anyone that you know, or if you can help us with working on these experimental technologies, we're really wanting to move that forward as soon as we can.
I can build what your staff sent me the blueprints on. That's not a problem. I looked at the prototype, and I saw why it won't work, but I can fix that.
Right. Excellent.
All right. I appreciate it.
Thank you
very much for your appearance.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good evening.
Bye-bye.
All right, Earth Explorers, that concludes our second hour. In our third hour, I would still like to get William Puckett on here, and we'll try to get Dr. Fred Bell on here as well. We'll take about a one-minute break, and then we will be right back. Thank you very much, Earth Explorers. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future, and remember, the result is always positive. On the line with us, our special guest, Bill Puckett, calling, we have managed to find him in the Northwest, where it is still daylight out there. He is, I believe you run a website called UFO Northwest.
That's correct. UFOsNW.com. I like people to go to that website and report their UFO sightings to me. I try to investigate all sightings that I receive, but I get quite a few, so sometimes I fall a little bit behind. But
that's all right. On our last hour, we had Dr. Stephen Greer with the Disclosure Project on. And we talked about UFO technology, energy technology, propulsion and communication technologies that have been reverse engineered by various groups, not the least of which is our government. But he grouped UFOs into two groups. One is an Earth-based UFO, and the other is an extraterrestrial UFO. And I asked him straight up if the Earth-based UFOs, that is to say artificial UFO that we have built here, reverse engineering alien technology, could make a right-hand turn at 10,000 miles an hour. And he said, absolutely.
Well, I would tend to agree with that. I've had a lot of reports of these flying triangles, and pretty much all over the world, although most of the cases I get are in the United States. And I understand I have a coworker who used to be a defense contractor for 10 years and was privy to some secret projects and knew some people that were associated with these projects.
Which defense area did he work in?
He said he worked for a place called Electronic Proving Ground, and I've never investigated it in depth, but he also knew a commander, ex-commander of a military base on a big island of Hawaii.
Well, did he have encounters? Did he have encounters with craft or with different technology?
No, he didn't have encounters with craft, but some of the people that he worked with had. But he said that these triangles are the TR-3D flying triangle, which is reverse-engineered alien technology, but it's very earthly right now. And we just get a tremendous number of these sightings, and I can't tell you how many I've had in the past couple of years.
I know we've had several here in North Carolina, specifically a dark colored, they could be black, they could be blue, it's hard to tell.
Right.
Flying at what appears to be, and of course, George Fawcett lives just a couple of miles away from me. And I've been to several of his events where people have talked about flying triangles. They call them black triangles, but of course it's difficult to tell at night. But they range in size from about 60 feet across to about 150 feet across, and they fly anywhere from 250 to 1,000 feet high.
Right.
And they usually fly pretty slow.
That's true. I had one case, I'm still working on it. It happened in Ohio this past August, where a woman had encountered one of these triangles, and it was flying very low over the highway. Her and her husband had a very strong odor to it, and she got sick and wound up having to go to the doctor a few times, and she was diagnosed with a kidney infection and chemical pneumonia. And the doctor that treated her, this is what she tells me, it's the first time she'd been to him, was quite familiar with UFO encounters causing physical problems in people, and apparently had worked for NASA. So you talk about disclosure, well, if this doctor used to work for NASA and he was familiar with these encounters, I guess that kind of speaks for itself.
That kind of ties things together, doesn't it?
Yeah. But she was quite ill and has subsequently recovered. But what had happened was that she had these brand new boots on, and they were synthetic suede finish on the boots, and the boots essentially got ate up, the finish on them, on this encounter. So I've sent the boots away to an organic chemist who works a lot with UFO cases. Haven't got the results yet, but you know, I'm hoping to get those in a month or so, and we're going to write up a report on it in the Mitchell UFO Network Journal.
Do any of your encounters, and even this one, mention the presence of angel hair with the appearance of the UFOs?
I haven't had any of those myself. I've heard of them, though, that, yeah, that's common. With this particular case, there was no debris. It was a gaseous, real strong odor.
Hmm. Was it flying really fast? You said it was flying low.
No, slow and low.
Huh.
Yeah, real slow and real low.
Were they in a vehicle, or were they just walking
they were
in the woods? Or
driving.
Ah,
late
okay.
at night, about midnight.
Goodness. And were they the only witnesses?
Yes. That's the unfortunate case with so many UFO sightings. Well, you know, there may be other witnesses, but, you know, either they don't report it, or they might report it to somebody else besides me. You know, I, when time permits, I always look on other UFO websites to see if other people, like Peter Davenport, the National UFO Reporting Center, or Brian Vike, or some of the other people that collect a lot of sightings, or George Filer.
Well, let me give you another website that you might want to link to yours, especially if you are collecting UFO sightings and evidence. it is called angelhair.info. And that is Brian Boldman, and he is one of the, that's the link. He is the world authority on angel hair, which is probably the only solid evidence left behind when a UFO using, a certain kind of fuel, leaves a residue. And this residue, sublimates very quickly, so it has to be captured in a jar or in a bag with as sterile methods as possible so that it can be retained. And then they can contact him through his website, and he will either pick it up or have it picked up, because he is collecting as much of this information as he can.
Well, I'll certainly go to his site, and if I ever get a case like that, I'll try to, you know, get some of the debris and send it to him.
Well, very good. And we will stay linked to your website and try to get as much contact with you and from you as we can.
Right. Yeah, I get about 5 to 7 sightings a week. But I got to tell you, Brooks, most of them are explainable.
Yeah.
And a lot of them would be explainable if I had more data. And, for example, I had a case. I live in the Seattle, Washington area in Puyallup, Washington. That would have been a week ago yesterday. Gentleman took a picture of a ring, a strange ring of smoke, smoky type ring with some debris coming out of it. And I'm a meteorologist, and I'm quite familiar with temperature inversions, and we had a pretty strong temperature inversion the past 10 days in this area. We're just breaking out of it now. And I realize a good possibility that this could be a ground release going up in the inversion and spreading out when it loses its buoyancy. But the thing that led me to not believe that was there were 4 carloads of witnesses that watched this, and they said it was a black line, and it turned on its axis and kind of revealed this distorted ring, and then it just disappeared.
Wow.
And when I heard all of this, I said, no, I don't think that's a ground level release. But the reason I'm bringing it up is I got an email from the gentleman, and I haven't had a chance to search into his background, but he said it was a ground release of a diesel engine. But I would say that, but given the witness testimony of how they said it evolved and how it disappeared, does not sound like a smoke ring going into an inversion, because it would gradually spread out. And I've investigated other smoke rings associated. They've been seen to have been associated with UFOs before. The most famous case is I might have the name wrong, Rex Heflin, 1965 in California, where he took these clear pictures with a Polaroid camera of a UFO, and then the fourth picture he took, the UFO had disappeared. It left this black ring. And there was another one at Fort Belvoir Army Base in 1957 of a black ring. That was reported to Project Blue Book. Subsequently, it was analyzed by the Condon Commission, and they concluded that it was a nuclear assimilation, but a lot of scientists have doubts about it. But anyhow, there's quite a history behind these rings, and I've had some other reports from England about them. And I mean, the gentleman that wrote to me might be right, but when I consider all the factors involved and the photograph in combination with what the witnesses told me, leads me to think otherwise. But, you know, I can't prove that. But it's just that it goes against what I feel, how it would have dispersed and disappeared. It wouldn't have disappeared, you know, instantaneously like he reported it.
Well, listen, I really appreciate your time to talk with us tonight. I'm going to try to get my final guest on tonight. Again, William Puckett, thank you very much for your time, and we'll keep UFONW.com listed.
NWS.com.
NWS?
Plurals, yes.
Oh, okay. UFONWS.com.
Right.
I've got it now. Very good, sir. Thank you for
having me, and I look forward to talking with you in the future.
No problem. We'll have you on again.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
All right, we are going to proceed to get Dr. Fred Bell on the phone, and then we will run through our final bit of our last hour. I'm going to do a commercial while my producer is dialing him up. The arc of millions of years explains why the Mayan calendar ends at the year 2012. Not only that, the detail in the book will help you understand why the Earth is going through such changes right now. Is the Earth really warming? Yes. In fact, all the planets in our solar system are warming. You want to know why? Read the book. Is the Earth from this solar system? Not entirely. Want to know the proof? Read the book. Are we alone in the universe? Absolutely not. You want to know who they are and why they have always been so interested in our planet? Read the book. It's always available at arcofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that with a K, like Noah's Ark. Or at your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth Booksellers, and now Davis Kidd Booksellers in Nashville, Jackson, and Memphis, Tennessee. So we'll now take a quick technical break while we dial in Dr. Fred Bell. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X-Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, and on the line with us tonight, our very special guest, Dr. Fred Bell. How are you this evening?
Good, Brooks. I've been listening to your program. Sounds like you've been having a lot of fun today.
Yeah, well, we're talking about probably one of the most popular subjects on the planet, or any planet for that matter, and that's UFOs. And we've talked about craft, we've talked about sightings, we've talked about technology, energy systems, communication systems. And now I would like to cover a subject that I do get inquiries from time to time, and I'm highly curious about myself. And that is the interaction between populations of Earth and populations of other planets. And one of the races that I repeatedly see come up in my research is the race called the Pleiadians. And I understand there's only a handful of quote-unquote experts on the planet on this race, and one of them is you. And so I am so privileged to have you on the program tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, actually. I know a little bit about Pleiadians, seeing as I've been working with them for about 30 years, so it gives me a chance to, you know their technology fairly well and how they do things, so I really like doing that.
Well, one of the things that continually piques my curiosity and people that I talk to is this interaction that we have had probably for thousands of years between various civilizations on the earth and off-worlders. If it were hostile, we would have been wiped off the face of the earth many times over. It's kind of like trying to fight against an M60 machine gun with a stone axe. But it appears as though they are not all hostile, although some of them do come here and appear to mutilate cattle and various animals and take samples here and there and terrorize farm animals. But some of them are concerned with the development and the metamorphosis of the human race itself.
Right. Well, the Pleiadians, every time, first of all, we rotate around the Pleiades every 26,827.5 years, so that's the precession of the equinox.
Right.
And in that period of time, civilizations rise and fall. The last one that fell was Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, there is intermingling between the extraterrestrial races. So therefore, when you look at the lifespan of a Pleiadian, it's up to 1,500 years, and you realize that they got relatives here. So it's in their best interest to protect their relatives that are here for, you know, human experience. So that's one reason why we don't have, them getting a little crazy with us. And secondly, they've given us a means of communication to back and forth, so we're able to communicate with them pretty frequently. That's not a problem either. But they do leave us alone because they don't want to interfere with our freedom of will. The Greys, on the other hand, the extraterrestrials, which are energy scavengers that have been coming here for just as long, are a highly evolved insect. They don't have a soul individual. They have an oversoul. So they have a different agenda, and that's sometimes who ships you see blow up in the sky when they get a little out of control. However, there are many different types of Greys, and, of course, some of them have made deals with our government and given us a huge amount of technology. Then there are other groups that come here. You know, there's the Andromedans that come here, and there's a group from Iargua that has been coming here. There's just different groups. The Lyrians have come here for a long time, and these are just some of the groups that I've had a little bit of interface with. Mostly my interface has been with the Pleiadians because it felt better. So, and then there's other contactees out there that have had inputs from races I can't even pronounce the names of, let alone understand. So, and it's all over the place. Contactees are all over the world. Some are real, some are not. And you just have to understand by having your own background who is and who isn't. But it's been going on for, like you say, thousands of years.
Well, they must have a place to reside, those that don't look like us and sound like us. And I understand Pleiadians are, except for their energy field, are very difficult to tell the difference from a normal human.
Right. They're at a higher frequency, and their reaction to the human aura is the aura we have, auric stench. So they don't usually get too involved with humans for long periods of time. In the environment here, the air is not very clear for them, so they don't breathe a lot of stuff. They don't want to get sick. Their immune systems are a lot different than ours. They're a lot more in the yin side of energy, because they can move up in frequency to the second ether, which then makes light almost go through them. So had they stay here a long period of time unprotected, they would lose that ability to do that. They would become too dense, and they couldn't then, they would then become trapped here. Which has happened to them. Others have been, their ships have been brought down due to the Greys giving us technology to arm some of our interceptors with some missiles that can penetrate their fields if their fields are down. And luckily, the Pleiadian propulsion system is such that it has a signature pattern in it, almost like a key on an automobile. And if the ship does go down, it can't be restarted and flown ever again. It'll never fly. It will hover, like some of the ones have been seen at Area 51 that Bob Lazar saw, but they'll never get them flying because key parts are destroyed permanently.
I see.
Yeah, so the technology that they have captured along their lines is pretty limited, what we can do with it.
So if we do have off-world populations of various races of various quantities, maybe several thousand, where would they reside?
Most of them are underwater. Most of them are in the oceans in different places around the world at the depth. That's why you see a lot of ships come out of the water. As a matter of fact, in the Third Reich, was the U-boat number 626 that was seen by a 626 saw it. Was one of the first ones recorded in the history of a ship coming out of the water, and a Nazi submarine commander seeing it, which really got Hitler's interest really going. This is back about, I think that happened around 1942, if I remember correctly.
So they've been here well before the atomic bomb or even... Now, one of the questions that came up when we were talking with Dr. Greer is that the superluminal drives that they have, they're able to travel vast distances across space without basically jumping into a tin can like we do and running along at 100,000 miles an hour, so they can actually slip in between dimensions of space or travel vast distances almost instantaneously.
Right. That's not a problem, because if you understand how space and time are constructed, there is no distance anyway. So it's
right, it's all time.
Yeah, it's just a matter of resonant points. And that, did you ever get that book? Did you ever call in and get that book sent to you?
I called in. It has not arrived yet.
Okay. Did you talk to Mitch when you called in? Or
I left a message.
Okay. Maybe that we've been so busy with Christmas, because I wanted you to see the propulsion systems that are in there.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, they're in my book, so... they do that. It's not a big deal. I mean, yeah, it's sort of interesting how it works, and we're moving forward in that direction, but I've been, cautioned by the plane is not to go too fast into this area, because the technology the receptivity here on Earth is a little bit slow to accept this stuff, and it's just been recent that we have a green light into the FDA just to get a Pleiadian device called a nuclear receptor. Okayed for, medical claims, because it does things medically to the body that are good. And so that's pretty far off from building a spaceship engine. But this one healing machine, which is also in my book, will be constructed this year. We'll be building one of the first prototypes. And in the same technology that allows a device to speed up the healing process of the body, in other words, the body can heal itself instantaneously if it's allowed to. And when you move technology in that direction, that same technology is the same technology that can warp space and time, because obviously if you can do it to a single cell on a molecular level, you can do it to a large object moving across space.
Mm.
Same technology. So,
well, I know that humans are typically not built for long-range space travel.
Well, they're not built... physically for long range space travel, the body, but the spirit can do that, and the body can be moved along with it. And I heard you guys were talking about teleportation, and I first learned about how practical it was from different yogis that I studied with, like Sai Baba, for example, can do that. Jesus did that. And so knowing that those principles exist in the human body, and knowing disciplines that I have been educated in called siddhis by the Tibetans, I have been able to explore the mechanism in the human body whereby teleportation is possible. And by exploring that inner principle allows me then to externalize this same principle into the universe, because basically everything in the universe is constructed in our bodies. It's all there. There's nothing missing. And what we can't see is what we can't comprehend. But as we move towards this precession of the equinox and move further into the higher frequencies of the universe, where our planet is going now, then our visibility for these kinds of phenomena becomes more clear. And that's pretty much where the world's headed right now. The beauty of it is that we're coming into a time when the government can no longer cover it up. Instead of us being in the fishbowl, they're now in it. And they're getting not only in it, but they're being lit by searchlights 24/7.
This is what happened the last time the Gutenberg press was invented. The scriptures got out there to where the church couldn't control them, and intelligent people learned from it and were inspired by it. And the next thing you know, you have a new Jerusalem. Now we have the next Gutenberg press, which for the last, 10 effective years, the internet has been disseminating information to all who can absorb it. And there are very smart people out there that are reading almost 24/7, getting their hands on as much of this information as they can, but some of the information is just not available. And that's what people like you and people like Stephen Greer and others are trying to get on there so that we can provide access to energy, access to technology that will provide freedom and some basic level of support for people on the planet.
Yeah, you know, and like he was saying earlier, because, you know, he lives in the Belt, we call all those the Beltway boys back there, because he's born and raised in D.C., so he knows everybody. And he knows well, as I do, that, you know, for example, just going out with hemp technology, ethanol produced by corn or hemp trees or any kind of a vegetable that produces ethanol, which, as we discussed the other night when we were talking on the phone, is zero emission exhaust, just that simple stuff, which we could grow, which we're now paying farmers, you know, thousands of dollars a year not to raise hogs, you know. And I was thinking of getting into the business of not raising hogs.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, and I was figuring out what brands like Berkshire's or Yorkshire hogs I wouldn't raise so I could qualify for that. You know? Yeah, and so when you look at a government that's run that stupid, And obviously, you know, companies like Halliburton, you know, control the Iraqi money and all of this sort of thing that goes on. They're not about to let any solution come along, let alone a free energy machine. That's completely off the list.
Yeah, well, it's no revelation that 300 or 400 people control, most of the wealth. I'm not talking about rich. I'm not talking about millionaires. I'm talking about wealth enough to buy governments.
Yeah, I know.
These 300 or 400 people control it all.
I know. When I met this friend of mine, he was a Pleiadian, and he was born there, and his name was Anthony James, and he was, when I met him, he was working with Margaret Habsburg's husband not Area 51, but over at Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived on a 40-acre estate, which was surrounded by NSA guards. And she was there, Margaret was there, and they had four Greys living on the compound with them that were working with some of the stuff. And as a matter of fact, one of the things that came out of there that Anthony brought out from there was the laser site that Sylvester Stallone used on his Rambo movie. I used to own that. I don't know where I put it. It was here, but the one they used in the movie. So it was interesting some of the things that came out of there, but living with four Greys, you know, it was really interesting. And when her husband died, that's when I met Anthony. He came out of there. Margaret got scared because she had no idea what was going to happen to her. But luckily, being one of the 12 families in the world, the richest families in Habsburg, they own 60% of Europe today as we speak, one family, and she's worth $4.3 trillion, not billion, but trillion dollars. And she moved to Palm Springs, and Anthony came out here, and the first thing she did is put him in a house over in El Segundo on the hillside, and it was about a 25,000-square-foot house. And I'd go visit Anthony, and he would, you know, you got to realize he's a Pleiadian. He's very timid, very paranoid. He had blonde hair, very thin, brilliant guy, completely. I've got a poem that before he left, he wrote a poem that's hanging on the wall. And so here's this Pleiadian living in a house that's 30,000 square feet with no furniture. And all he's got in there is one of my pyramids he's sleeping under because he had to protect himself from this environment. It's all my paradigm stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then she goes ahead and makes a deal with the CIA, who was her protector in Palm Springs, and she's allowed to bring one cathedral over and $1 billion a year into this country. That's all she's allowed to bring in.
Oh, that's it, huh?
Yeah, $1 billion, and that's a B. I don't know how much. So Margaret, the next thing Tony tells me, I call him Tony. Tony says, well, she's going to give me a little furniture now, you know. And the next thing I go over there and to his 25,000-square-foot house, and the place is furnished, and every piece of furniture is from old Victorian Europe, and the dresser is probably worth $10 million.
Wow.
So imagine 25,000 square feet, suddenly fills up with heirlooms that they consider junk worth probably many, many, many millions of dollars. And then he stayed there for a little while, and then he went back home. And I don't know what happened to the place, but he told me he wouldn't stay here long, and he didn't, and he left. But he was always timid. He was afraid. He drove this great big, a van, like a 4x4 around. And he had the best of everything, but he was the most humble guy and brilliant, beyond brilliant. And he did work for NSA, obviously, with her husband. So he was one that was actually brought here, stayed here. I got to spend some time with and then left. And he imparted on me a lot of knowledge. And sometime I'll read to you the poem that he wrote before he left. And so I know what these people are like. They're amazing people, but they can't stay here too long. And I've had, very close association with the highest threads of this huge inner circle that you guys have been talking about.
So they are concerned with the development of the human race?
The Pleiadians are not, because their only concern is that it will cause the disruption. They worry about disruption. They don't really worry about it, but they won't intervene ever. Other races will, but the disruption of the normalcy of the universe and the solar system and the planetary system caused by some of the stupid things that we do here. And so for that reason, they've been monitoring us for a long time, obviously, long time. And Pleiadians stopped having war about 26,000 years ago on their home world. So they won't do intervention, because intervention would only give them a karmic feedback, whereby they would be having wars again someplace.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. It may not be with us, but it would be somewhere, because they understand the laws of karma. And so they're very sensitive that way. Whereas, and also the Pleiadians, their names are found in our history, like Semyasi's name is, Semyas, a prophet. And Ptah, her father, who is also would be known as an Egyptian king. That name came from there.
And Quetzal.
Yeah, Quetzal. And then a lot of some of the Egyptians were contactees, going all the way back 3,000 years ago when, I forget the names of all the different ones. I used to know the entire lineage going back 5,000 years. I used to rattle off, but the gods, there's a group of beings also that's right over on the astral plane. And their names were like Osiris, which is the Pleiadian pronunciation, Osar. Let's see what was said, Osiris, Horus, all of these different names, Horus being the son of Osiris, his wife, Isis. And these are lineages that came from the astral plane down through the etheric plane that the Atlanteans used for names over a long period of time. And things like the Ankh and other amulets were early versions of something like our nuclear receptor that were used as tools to help the body do different things and perform different kinds of ceremonies. So if you go deep enough into history, you'll find a lineage of succession between extraterrestrials and humans. Mostly through, kings that were good and civilizations that lasted a long time and left large amounts of mementos like the Egyptians did.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, and I worked with Egypt quite a bit in this lifetime, and Zawi, who's in charge of the Great Pyramid today, I remember when he came over here as a 19-year-old kid wearing no shoes, and we did a lecture together up in Santa Barbara. And so today he's the curator of the pyramid. And one of the things that I've learned in working with that government for a long period of time is that one thing that they don't want to get out is the fact that Egypt really isn't a race in itself. It's a part of the Bedouin group, which would go back to Babylon, which of course would be located in Iraq, southern
mm-hmm.
Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And so Egypt was nothing. The Egyptians are nothing more than the Bedouins that became caretakers of the Atlantean artifacts.
Right.
Are the great pyramids. They're not the Zoser pyramid that was built, 3,000 years ago, the first one, but in Saqqara, but the real, the big stuff, in the big chambers and the underground stuff, they're just caretakers of it. And I know for a fact that when they do excavations over there, they do find Atlantean artifacts. but they'll never see the light of the day in a museum because that would discredit their whole civilization. So those
dig out the Sphinx, which was built at least 2,000 years before the Egyptians.
Yeah, well, the Sphinx, I think, well, it has watermarks on it,
mm-hmm.
High watermarks on it, like the Great Pyramid does. So it would predate the flood of Noah. And as far as I know, the Great Pyramid, based on lime that grows out of the cracks in the pyramid, has been dated back 75,000 years. So it goes way, way, way back. Now, it's had a lot of modifications and things done to it, but originally the core structure was built that long ago, I believe, you know, from my point of view.
Yeah, and not the first macro architecture that's been inherited by a group. When Tula and the, or I'm going to call them classic age Mayans, took over Teotihuacan, all of that was there.
Yeah.
It was all built. But the strange thing about it is, although it was a city capable of holding at least 200,000 people, maybe more, there was not a single trace, not a book, not a shard of pottery, nothing left behind.
Yeah, it's funny because I always tell people when the sun rises on the pyramid of the sun, it sets on the pyramid of the moon over here in South America and vice versa. And the pyramid of the moon has all the measurements and calculations of the moon and its relationship to Earth, whereas the pyramid of the sun has the calculations of our relationship to the universe and the sun, the average heights of the Earth and land masses and all that stuff. So,
well, I could tell you, I was standing on top of it about 7 weeks ago.
Which one, the pyramid of the moon or the one of the sun?
I was going to climb to the top of both, I'll be honest. It's about 7,500 feet altitude. I climbed to the top of the Temple of the Moon.
Yeah.
And I have asthma. I made it to the top of there. By the time my heart settled down, I took a few photographs and I noticed the most amazing sky. There were these longitudinal lines going toward the sun that were just unbelievable. I almost couldn't take my eyes off of them. And I climbed down to the Street of the Dead again and walked, a quarter of a mile down to the Temple of the Sun. And that thing was 180 feet high, and I just didn't have the wind to get to the top of it. And I regret it, but we had to get on to Tula.
Yeah.
So I didn't stay. I did not climb to the top of the Temple of the Sun.
Well, that's too bad, but that's all right. Another trip, another day.
Another trip, another day. Absolutely. I was there to gather photographs for this volume 2 of our book, which is coming out next month.
Oh, good. That'll be really good. You might try another idea, too, that I'm going to do with Don. In my book, my other book that you haven't gotten yet has 412 illustrations. It's got a lot of drawings. It's called The Telephone Book. It weighs 4.5 pounds. And it's big, and we were talking about that. But what I'm going to do with my new book, which is written more to the layperson, not a big technical journal, and that is going to be illustrated over on Blog and Service, so that they can go to blogandservice.com and see animations and things that we're going to put together from the book over there on that website. Because I figure the website's going to be around for a while.
Oh yeah.
So you might consider, on your page over there, and putting some of the material that you drawings and things that might be too complicated or expensive or time consuming to put in your book, you might think about putting them over there on the
website. Yeah, I could certainly do that.
Yeah, and that way I think it starts a new trend of book and internet connection that makes, not only brings traffic to us and listeners to us, but it also gets, we can get a lot more information out there.
That's the idea. We want to get the information out there because there are people that, I know it's hard to believe, but there are people out there that are smarter than we are.
I know, it's great, isn't it?
And they might actually know a missing piece that we don't have that'll put all this together and make it sing.
Yeah, and the kids coming up today, which is what my work is really all about, I've met some of these kids that are way smarter than me, and they're 5 and 6 and 7 years old, some of them, and it's really neat to talk to them, but they talk right with me, and sometimes they go over my head a little bit because their imaginations are a little bit more free running than mine. And so they see things a little bit clearer than we do, at least
that, and they're going to have access to the internet all of their lives, whereas we really only had access to it the last 10 or 12 years.
Exactly, and the internet's going to be one of the things that the Pleiadians have. They showed me on their ship one time, because I asked them, Yossi, well, what do you guys do for television? She laughed. And she showed me a chamber. And we're actually going to have this pretty soon. And it was connected to the Akashic Record, and it was like a little theater. It was like about, you know, 2 or 3 feet wide and 2 or 3 feet deep and 2 or 3 feet high, little box, you know, in area. And it's three-dimensional, so you could see the images of what was going on. And being tuned into the Akashic Records, the thing that I got to see was an actual ship being tossed around in a storm probably about 300 or 400 years ago, an old sailing ship. And probably, I guess, it sunk. But seeing this thing in three-dimensional, seeing the sailors fight the waves and seeing it animated in three dimensions was pretty interesting. It was a pretty neat technology.
Like holographic television.
Yeah, like holographic television. And that's pretty much what it was, but it was a true event that happened in the past, because their tuner goes to the Akashic Records. So I thought that was pretty cool. So I got to see, you know, what that was all about. And the other thing that I noticed is with their ships inside, the sounds are pretty musical. And when they're moving, the sounds are pretty much will put you out there in orbit themselves, just the sounds of the ship, the way they sound when they're running. So they don't sound like an airplane or a turbine or anything like that. They have this beautiful, deep, thundering, throbbing sound, and then this higher stuff that kind of floats around in there. So they have sound and picture. So they do have entertainment, just a little bit more different than ours, you know.
Dr. Greer was mentioning ways of communicating with off-worlders. He called it CE5, Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind.
Right, I understand.
And he mentioned a communication protocol, which he is disseminating, and he does seminars several times a year to teach people how to initiate contact with off-worlders. And he mentioned using a flashlight, a laser, electronic tones and certain frequencies, radio transmissions. And then probably the one that was the most exciting to me, even as a physicist, I see this, and I'll explain why in a moment.
Yeah.
He called it coherent thought.
Right.
That an individual or a group of individuals can generate a communication using thought.
Exactly.
And this will bring a UFO in the area to communicate with you.
Yeah, we not only do we do that, but we developed a device that amplifies it for groups. It's called a Firestar. And the first time I really used one, I don't know if I told you, did I tell you the story about the concert that I played using that? Because we took it around Europe.
No.
Billy Myers blew his mind with it. I had a Firestar set up in a concert hall in Marnau, Germany, in the Bavarian Alps. And I had about 500 people there. We were doing a channeling conference. Kevin Ryerson was there. He was the star. He was Shirley MacLaine's leading psychic at the time. And myself and a few other people. And it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I started playing. I was playing this rock opera that I did that was in the Cannes Film Festival twice, called Fellowship the Sound, which sometimes plays on this network, some of the sounds from it. And about 11 o'clock, all of a sudden, I saw people. There was 500 in the audience, and about 50 people ran out of the hall. And the concert hall is in the Alps. It's imagine snowed outside. It's a big A-frame building, but it's like 100 feet tall on the A-frame side with the windows, 100 feet high of glass, you know.
Wow.
It's beautiful. And so anyway, people ran out just as I was ending the concert. And at the point of the concert, I had the Pleiadian ship that we'd recorded playing, and I was playing some synthesizers along with it. And we were shooting the lasers into the Firestar, which is a communicating device. And when the 50 people ran out, and the next thing I heard is two Swiss Mirage jets fly by, and wham! You know, the sound hit the side and rattled the glass, almost broke it. And then, of course, the concert ended, and as the concert was ending, I could see the blue flash reflecting off the windows from the front part of the building where the police cars were arriving, you know, with their blue.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And what had happened is, at the end of my concert, three Pleiadian ships had come down to Marnau and hovered over the building. And while they were hovering over the building, it created a big disturbance, and they cordoned off the town, and the German equivalent of the NSA was there that night. And it made all the newspapers. You can probably still find that on the Internet. And that was just one of many times that we've had major experiences like that. I did a concert like that down in St. Louis, Missouri about 4 years ago. The same thing happened down there. It was in the front pages of the newspapers. And anybody pretty much that ever bought a Firestar from us, it's about a $5,000 purchase with all the lasers and stuff that goes with it, pretty much has had an experience about usually on the 90th day. And I sold one to a guy named Warner Ahrens. He lives, was my distributor in Hamburg. And he kept calling me. I said, this is usually what happens. You know, he was at that thing in Marnau, so he knew something happened there. And so, anyway, I sold him a unit, and I was staying down in Munich at the time at one of my other distributors' houses. Then got my house over in Ammersee, at which we later on moved into. But he kept calling me and calling me, and I said, Werner, the ship will come. He had a big five-story house, and he had a holistic center there, and people came from all over Europe to visit his center to learn Reiki and all the stuff he taught. So he's a pretty high-minded person, and his bedroom was like a glass house. It was like a greenhouse up on the top floor. It was beautiful, with plants looking right outside. And so anyway, he kept bugging me, when's the ship going to come, you promised. I said, just give it time. I give it time. And so I was staying at Johannes' house, Fisslinger, that's the guy's name I was staying with him. He kept bugging me about every day, and finally, on the 90th day, I didn't hear from him on the 89th day, but on the 90th day, I'm sitting in there, we're doing some yoga in Johannes' house, and there's a knock on the door. Well, Hamburg's quite a ways away, and there is standing Werner.
Oh, really?
And I said, Jesus, this guy is, you know, aggressive. It's only been 90 days. And he says, that's the point. And he ran in, and he had this video. It was on PAL. And I have the video here somewhere. It's on PAL. What had happened is his ship that he wanted was coming. And it just so happened that a friend of his had a BMW convertible, and it was going over to Werner's little ashram house, and he was coming. And it's right off a freeway there in Hamburg. And he had his video camera, and a big ship, a big disc came down, and was flying right down the freeway, and this guy's videoing it. And he videos it right up to Werner's house. And he's going on a video of the ship hovering over Werner Ahrens' house.
That's the place to be.
Yeah, and Warner's the guy that I did an album with called Galactic Meditation that sold very well in Europe. We did that right afterwards. Yeah, so I mean, we get results. I don't know if Steven's used any of our stuff or not, but I know that Eric Von Daniken uses Firestar. He used to do the same thing that Steven does. He did that down at Tenerife and in Spain. And so they used our Firestars for their gatherings down there and to bring the ships in. So
it takes the vibrations of harmonious and pleasing music and converts it or transmits it?
What it does, it amplifies. First of all, most people are overcoming gravity. It takes a lot of their energy and they're overcoming toxins. So it puts the body in a pretty powerful detox. And then what happens is it aligns your aura frequency so you can go within into the hydrogen, because this communication is done through the animation of a hydrogen atom. So it allows you to align yourself, and you sit in front of it, and it projects its power into it. And then what happens is you get an extension of the aura, because the aura, even though it's got an electromagnetic component, also has an etheric and astral component. So it amplifies those, and the laser shooting into the crystals in the center of the fire star amplifies the whole effect and draws you into it. And as it draws you into it, it transmits like a beacon. It becomes like this beacon. It's usually hung on the north wall, and uses the Earth's field to amplify it. The Earth's aura itself, the Earth's magnetic field, amplifies this. So it extends your aura, which is good through space and time, all over the universe in a focused manner. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that's how the Pleiadians communicate back and forth. They have something like a fire star. Semyonti gave me the design in the first place, but we have a miniature version of it called a microstar now that you can carry around and take it to your apartment building or your hotel room when you're traveling. As a matter of fact, Don ordered one. He's going to be getting one from me. And so we can do this in a smaller version, but the big one is the one that I recommend. We were, there's another girl that will probably join our radio group. Her name is Dr. Ann West, and her husband is David Tickle. David Tickle produces Sting and U2, and he's a big band producer. And I remember when Sting was writing Shake, Rattle, and Hum, he had one of my fire stars at David's house, and he was staying there with the whole band, U2, and they were using it on a daily basis, the drug and alcohol-free band. And they had visitations inside the pyramid with the fire star. And I wasn't over in Europe at the time, but they told me, you know, I heard about it from Bono that this is what was going on when they wrote, did Shake, Rattle, and Hum, and they recorded it, and David had 3 Firestar orbs in his studio, and when, Shake, Rattle, and Hum hit the road, I mean, got out there, it sold 30 million albums in them until Michael Jackson did Thriller, which topped it. It was the largest selling single album in the history of albums, period.
My goodness.
Yeah, then we had another episode with it. A few years later, this is at his Calabasas studio. He's over in Hawaii. He's there now. He's, as we speak, he's in L.A. recording a big band. But in the Calabasas studio, they had 3 of them in the studio, Firestars, and one of them fell off and broke. And now David gets about up to $10,000 a day to record, you know, because Interscope's a big company, and he gets paid a lot of money, $1 million an album usually. So he had this group called the Four Non-Blondes.
And, I remember them.
Yeah, well, they were there. And so they're a big bunch of girls, very powerful women to say the least. And so they're recording. And I get a call from David, and he says, the Firestar fell off the ceiling. I said, so?
They recorded, hey, what's going on?
Yeah. And so I said, so what? So it fell. Fix it. He says, I can't. He says, you get up here. He's 100 miles away now. He says, Fred, would you get up here, please, and fix this thing? We're stopping the recording because the girls are used to the energy, and they won't go any further with it. And so I said, okay. So I got in my car, and I drove all the way up to Calabasas, which is up past Malibu in the background up in the hills, put the damn thing back on it was in the morning. I had it back up and running by about 9 o'clock at night. Well, they were having a problem. We got the music going again, and then they were having a problem with the guitar player at the time. She finished the album but never played live with him again. Cause some people, when you record them, and they get them under a microphone, they just can't go like they do live. They just get scared. I've had that happen in my studio too. So they're in there. So David's inside with the guitar player at the time, and the other 3 girls and I are outside the patio, and it's a beautiful kind of a setting. Firestar is back up, and as soon as I'm sitting out there with the girls, And all of a sudden, this beautiful saucer came down, gorgeous thing, and it hovered right over the top of his studio, and we were about 100 feet towards the swimming pool away from it on this big, beautiful lawn. And this thing came down and hovered there for about 30 seconds. The girls were just blown away. If you ever meet the Four Non-Blondes, they'll tell you that story, and they'll never forget that experience. Of course, David was inside hassling the other girl, getting her to work, and so when they got done, because we were basically kicked out of the studio at that point, because there was a lot of energy going on. So, because that's the way he is. He wants absolute, you know, attention when he's working with somebody. So the band themselves are out there with me, and this happened. And so then a little bit later, he comes out, and he's finished with her, and then she comes out, the other girl, the fourth girl. And the other 3 girls told both of them what happened. And they, of course, were incredibly disappointed that they missed this phenomenal event over the top of David's studio. So that was another incident that the Four Non-Blondes can testify to if you ever reach them. If anybody out there knows them, we'll just ask them, and they'll remember that one really well.
Oh,
and it goes on. We could sit here for 2 hours and give you one event after the other. The bottom line is we got Firestars all over the world, everywhere. I've got attorneys that use them. One of my attorneys uses them. He's a family attorney, and he's become number one attorney for families in Southern California. He's head of
not
council.
Only
he's the Firestar.
Off-worlders, but it could also enhance your individual karma and detoxify your spirit.
Yeah, let me tell you something. Barbara Streisand's, David had a girlfriend before he was married to Anne. He had a girlfriend named Valentina Vargas, and this is back in the 80s now. And David had just finished a movie called Purple Rain with Prince at Paisley Park, and he just moved out to Malibu. And Valentina was starting her acting and singing career. Well, she had to have a Firestar because it made her sing better. If you open your arms and spread your arms behind you and you stand up and you sort of stretch backwards and sing, it opens up your throat chakra because we use a lot of emeralds. We muscle test. The thing looks like a giant cross, and at the end of each, like a big X, and at the end of each X in the center is a small thing that looks like a nuclear receptor. It's not, but it looks like it. And there is a stone, and we muscle test you for 5 different frequencies of the hydrogen atom or 5 different chakras. And that's what we put in those different areas around the Firestar. So you're tested so that's actually tuned to you.
Wow.
So then Valentina's, her acting coach was Barbara Streisand's acting teacher also. I mean vocal coach, because they both sing and act. So he came over And he saw, he called me up and he said, Cyan, he says, you know, Valentina's got this thing on the wall in there and it makes her sing better. And I says, yeah, that's the fire star. It opens up her, she had a blockage in her throat chakra and that's why that's full of emeralds, you know, because it had emeralds in it. He says, can I borrow it? It's pretty big. And I says, well, yeah, I guess he talked to her. Well, she doesn't really want it going out of the house because it's big, but he borrowed it and he took it over to Barbara Streisand because if you remember the time that when she was not singing, she went off. Okay. Then she had to come back. Well, she couldn't sing. And Barbara, one of my friends recorded half her albums. He says, if there's one note not punctuated or accentuated in her entire song, the song is trashed until that one note is fixed. And thank God, hopefully another note doesn't go bad. That's how strict she is. So she,
we have about 30 seconds.
Yeah. She got up and she used that fire star and, she got out and sang afterwards. She got her octave back. So it's,
wow.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be on your show. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, I appreciate it so much. And we're going to have more shows on this very subject several times in the coming year.
Yeah.
We're not going to be on Christmas Day or New Year's Day, but we'll be back on January 8th. And I appreciate so much, Dr. Bell, being on the program tonight.
Yeah, and I'll have you on my show, too, at some point.
Yeah, excellent. Superb idea.
We'll get some projects going, and we'll talk about it on the air, and have some fun.
Sounds good. Let's build something.
Yeah, we'll build something. I'm ready.
All right. Thank you, sir, and good night.
Okay.
Earth Explorers, I would like you to remember one thing before we go. I want you to remember who you are. We are entering the most incredible seven-year period in the coming history. Every prophet, every seer, and every scientist has looked for this day. We will make tremendous breakthroughs in healthcare, control and clean energy, and space exploration. We will directly observe our first black hole. We will rediscover the true nature of the Earth. The knowledge has been restored. Now all we have to do is use it. And this is Brooks Agnew, your host of X Squared Radio. I will be returning to the airwaves January 8th. We will be taking Christmas Day and New Year's Day off. Thank you very much, listeners, for being a part of our program, and we will see you next year. Thank you, and good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.